I'd like to call the joint meeting of House Resources and House Finance to order. On the Resources Committee, in attendance, we have Representative Crawford, Ledoux, Samuels, Ramirez, Seaton, Olson, and Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the finance members, we have Representative Hawker sitting in the back there. Representative Jewell, Vice Chairman Stoltz, myself, Chairman Meyer, Co-Chairman Chenault, and Representative Holm. I believe that's all we have at this time.
Okay. It's a joint meeting. We'd like to try to make the members on those two committees available to have their seats that are either marked or up here. But in addition, we also have been joined by the Minority Leader, Representative Berkowitz, Representative Guerra, Rules Chairman, Representative Rokeberg, Representative Newman, Representative Gardner, the Speaker.
Oh yeah,
the boss. Thank you, Representative Hawker. Today we're going to continue our discussions on House Bill 488. Representative Catul is also with us on the Finance Committee. We're going to continue our debate on our discussion on House Bill 488, and with us we have Daniel Johnston. Please come forward, Mr. Johnston. To make sure that we get through our presentation, we're going to hold all questions until the end of the presentation. So if you have a question on a term or a concept, jot it down, and we'll try to get to as many questions and answers as we can at the end. And the preference will probably go for the Q&A to the Resource and Finance Committee members, since we are have the entire House here right now. So with that, if you can start maybe with by way of introduction and then begin your presentation, Mr. Johnston. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committees, for the record, I'm Daniel Johnston. I live in Hancock, New Hampshire. I'm an independent financial consultant to the petroleum industry. And can you hear me behind as well?
I know. They don't mean anything back there.
Thank you, sir. I founded my independent consulting practice a little over 20 years ago. I've been doing this kind of work for nearly that entire time and started doing this kind of work even before then. I do three kinds of work. Consulting work, similar to what I'm doing here. I teach courses both in a public setting. I do in-house courses, and I teach at the University of Dundee. I used to teach at the University of North Texas, the Institute of Petroleum Accounting, before I moved from Texas to New Hampshire 6 years ago. The third type of work that I do is expert witness work, and I've testified in a number of arbitrations and litigation, and have been involved in a few mediations. It's that kind of work that sort of gives me, I think, sometimes particular insight into some of the problems that can arise with fiscal systems design and contract design. In the past 15 years, half of my work has been for governments and half for oil companies. So I have a lot of sympathy and understanding, I feel, for the plight that companies face and for the agony that government officials have to go through at times like this. And as many times as I've been through that with governments, this is one of the most exciting and dynamic and dramatic circumstances I've ever seen. So it's an honor to be here, and the foundation of my attitude towards all of what we're doing is the mineral wealth of a nation or a state like Alaska is a gift from God. And you, the representatives of the state, are, in that respect, custodians of the nation's wealth. And I consider what you do particularly important because your counterparts in the oil companies have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. There's no doubt about that. But you have, I think, a higher calling and are required to exercise more of a sacred trust. And I hope that I can be part of that. May God have mercy on us all. My mandate has been, as many of you know, to analyze and then discuss with you today the proposed tax system that the administration submitted about a month ago. And it was at that time, like many of you, I suspect, too, that I first saw what was being proposed and also had first heard any discussions of that sort. So things have been moving quite quickly, and you might be surprised to learn how much I don't quite know yet about what's being proposed. We have plenty of time to explore that. I hope to spend maybe a little over an hour discussing some of the issues that I consider so important and some of the areas of concern and any recommendations that I have. And I hope I can keep it to an hour and a half. And then I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have. It might seem like a hollow promise that I'm going to try to last for only an hour and a half for formal presentation when I've handed you a 60-page report. But many of the things that I think are important that I think you might appreciate having additional information about are in the back of the report so that you can read them later at your leisure. And I think they will provide insight and foundation for many of the discussions that you'll hear today and in the future. My mandate has been then to analyze, research, discuss, and recommend. The main objective was to help hopefully design a fair system. And I think it's clear in most people's mind that nobody wants a punitive arrangement, neither the government side nor the oil company side. Every single day and late at night, so many times, I think of what the future generations will ask, and it's awful to think of how far out in the future they're going to look back and consider what we've done in this day. Did we design the right fiscal system with the best information, tools, and resources available to us? And that's what we're trying to do, consistent with the boundary conditions and the objectives and the concerns of the citizens of Alaska. Diverse boundary conditions, diverse concerns, and numerous objectives. It's a very difficult job. Did we negotiate effectively and from a position of strength? That's a big question and a big issue. And if we didn't, did we do the best we could with what we have? And finally, and equally as important, did we manage for future generations to strengthen or weaken their bargaining position that they'll be faced with in the future? And this is something that worries me so much, because every time I've worked for a government, one of the first things I learn and try to get a feel for is just how strong their bargaining position is. Sometimes in some countries, the governments have considerable power and leverage. But that's not often the case. I mean, not always the case. Many times, too, the industry, whether it's the oil industry or other major industries, sometimes have more the characteristics of a sovereign and exert greater power than the government officials do themselves. And it's just a heartbreaking, gut-wrenching, sad experience to see that. And it's difficult to be involved in that when I see the frustrations that these people have to deal with. I have on page 5 of my report a long-winded and exhaustive section of whining and caveats and disclaimers. This situation is so complex. I have to say I've tried to put together as much as I can, as quickly as I can. But I don't have all of the answers yet, and you might find that I'm full of questions and light on answers, but we'll see what we can do with what we've got. The conclusions, basically as they stand right now, and you might as well go through them now and give you a feel for them, almost all of which I believe to a certain extent, some in greater detail, are substantiated in the discussion to follow and in the pages behind this page here. There's been a lot of debate as to whether or not Canada, Alaska even has the right to make a change in the system. And there are claims that it would create an unstable environment and a bad perception in the eyes of industry and future investors. First of all, I believe that Alaska has every right to change the system, and perhaps more right to change the system than many other countries. And there's a number of reasons for that. We have a system here that's outmoded, and almost everybody that I've talked to realizes that as far as fiscal system design, it's a regressive system, but worse yet, it's more regressive than the average system, and it's more regressive than a typical regressive, inefficient system for a variety of reasons. Royalties, by their very nature, are regressive, but most governments know they have to have at least some guarantee that they're going to get something each and every accounting period. The severance tax, that system was also regressive because it was based on gross production for all practical purposes. But there were also the additional inefficiencies associated with the the structure of the economic limit factor, one being that it was in part a function of production rate per well, and another a function of production rate per field. These particular types of elements, and I'll discuss a few examples that I've seen worldwide, can create a situation where the interests of the companies are not well aligned with the government. And when those things happen, false economies often are created that really are heartbreaking because it creates waste. And if you really believe that mineral resources of a country are a gift from God, then waste is a sin. It may sound a little heavy, but that's the way I feel. And I think probably many of you do too, really, if you think about it. In my opinion, what we're trying to do here is, some people say, is contradictory, that we're trying to increase revenues, increase taxes for the state of Alaska, but at the same time to enhance exploration activity. And I do not believe that those two objectives are mutually exclusive. I think that we can achieve both, but it's not going to be easy. One of the reasons I say that is, in my experience in this world, and I think it justifies further research so that you can be more comfortable with it than even I am right now, raising taxes, in my experience, and I've seen it a number of times, is not as elastic as people think. With the petroleum industry, where there's existing production, many times when taxes have been increased, the existing production continues. The only reason that it might dramatically discontinue is if perhaps the taxes were really raised way too much, or the companies decided to penalize the government and punish them, but they'd be punishing themselves as well. So at least in that respect, there is an alignment of interests. The incentives that are proposed, that have been suggested with the PPT, I've seen in a number of places around the world, and these things work, and they work quite well. So what I hope to convince you is that, at least in my experience, there's solid justification for the credits and the notion of having credits to encourage exploration, but at the same time, raising the taxes isn't going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. We've heard that cliche so many times, I might as well use it myself. Especially the level of increase that's being contemplated here. And we'll talk about just how cruel and unusual that might be in the context of what's happening in this world today. In my opinion, if we're going to design a new system, this is the time to do it. The time for change is now. And if we're going to design a new system, it has to be a modern system. And it's absolutely critical, in my opinion, that if we have a system that really will qualify as a modern system of today, the year 2006, it has to be flexible and progressive. There's a considerable amount of overlap in those two terms, actually, but it also needs to be simple, if possible, and transparent, and everybody's working towards that end, there's no doubt. Trying to craft one system to fit all situations here may be impossible. In my opinion, I can hardly sleep at night agonizing over how difficult and uncertain and complex this thing is. And when I see complex systems, I immediately think, I wonder how long it'll be before I'm hired as an expert witness to sort out the disputes. And I've testified in probably 20 disputes around the world. And I'll tell you a little bit about a few of them because they'll provide some particular insight for your situation, I believe. And there's a number of things everybody can read. The conclusions, I'll jump to the item number 5, which causes me considerable amount of concern. And this, the issue of fiscal certainty and the request demand by the producers with both the gas pipeline negotiations and the oil tax negotiations, that they achieve fiscal certainty. Now, I'll say this, I don't blame you, especially with the gas pipeline. In fact, a certain amount of certainty, a high level of certainty is going to be required for the gas pipeline, and that's just a fact, in my opinion. And quite a bit of certainty in regards to the duration of that contract, because it would take, maybe I don't need to talk about gas now. I keep forgetting. I apologize, make my speech a little shorter. Now, much of the debate here revolves around government take, and some of you, the term government take is probably a little bit new, and you hear it over and over and over, and to a certain extent that's a good thing because it's an important statistic, and it's an important means by which we can get a feel for whether or not Alaska might be getting a fair share and or whether or not the changes that are being proposed are going to be sufficient, appropriate, and fair for the circumstances here. I will say this, and I'll quit harping about the gas pipeline project. We're going to talk about government takes so much here, you might expect that it would be a huge issue when it comes to the next phase. But with the gas pipeline project, it's not quite the appropriate statistic that it is here. It's not perfectly appropriate for these conditions, but just remember I said these words. It's not all about government take, and particularly true when you talk about the gas pipeline that's being proposed. Number seven, crafting language to avoid leakage deserves appropriate terms on the front end. We've got to get the deal right. Get your share of the revenues right, and yes, Ben will certainly worry, at least I will. I know people are already worried about that. You'll find I haven't given much consideration yet to all of the forms of leakage, because sometimes people want to talk to me about a potential source of leakage of your tax base from this area or that area, and they're talking about very small things when the big picture is you've got to get the tax rate right first, because you can lose so much money getting that wrong. There are several issues that I just haven't had time to explore since I've been here. Relinquishment provisions. You're a little bit behind in this world to a certain extent, but not as bad as some countries are, as far as this issue of relinquishment provisions. And there's going to be a need for some considerable work, both for facilities that are going to be put in place after today, and then for those facilities that were put in place before the year 2006. And I use the term abandonment provisions, and that's just a bad habit. It conjures up visions for some people of abandoning a child or something like that. The more politically correct terms these days are site restoration, cleanup, dismantlement, and I'm happy with those terms. In my book, they all mean the same thing. The proposed linkage between the gas pipeline keeps me awake at night, too, and I'm sure it does you, too. This is going to be very difficult, and the risks associated with this unique situation are truly immense. Now, I mentioned that I would give some other perspectives on the ELF situation, and my international experience, for all practical purposes, started in Norway and Indonesia. The first year that I started doing this work in 1981, the first time I started traveling in this work was in 1981. Indonesia had a fiscal device that they referred to as the domestic market obligation holiday. And it was simply a situation where the oil companies had 5 years of, you could think of it as royalty-free living, and then after 5 years, after the holiday, the royalty kicked in. Because of that, the oil companies had a strong incentive to do two things. One, to produce the oil as quickly as possible. Not a big problem there. But they also had a strong incentive to obtain separate fuel status, because the holiday, the clock started ticking on a field-by-field basis. And the first time I saw that, it surprised me. I saw a map of a company's acreage, and I never saw so many prospects in my life. If it would have been an ordinary map, there might have been 50 or 100 prospects. This map had 500 prospects. Every bump that they could see on the seismic data, they gave it a different name, because they felt that if they did that from the very beginning, the likelihood would be that they would better enable themselves to obtain separate fuel status down the road. The problem with a thing like that is, and I saw it with a company that was represented here indirectly these last few days, they were acquired a while back. This company had tried to acquire separate fuel status for two different fields. One field had been developed, production had started, and 3 years later, they drilled an adjacent structure. The Indonesian government went to them and said, that's not two separate fields, that's the same field. So they decided to drill a well between the two structures so that they could prove to the government that in fact, perhaps, the two fields were separate. They were hoping that they really would drill a dry hole. On the seismic data, it looked like there was a good chance that the structure did dip down into the water. Imagine the inefficiencies associated with a system where an oil company was actually incentivized to drill a dry hole. Imagine the oil company personnel hoping that that hole would come up dry. These are the kind of things, the false economies associated with problems that can occur, especially when we design things for the first time. Whenever I'm involved in fiscal design and I see something new, I get a sick feeling in my stomach, because I've seen over the years that with new elements, it often takes 10 years for the contract language to evolve to the point where all the kinks and problems have been worked out. That's part of my concern about what we're dealing with here. If the system is going to be changed, what is the criteria? The system must be progressive. There's no doubt about that in my mind. Full stop, it absolutely has to be done. I've been saying that since August. And I know I was talking about the different situation back in August. We will not get off of that. We're going into the future, and of the 60% of the countries on this planet, every single one of them today wishes they had a progressive system. The few countries in this world, about 20-25%, that actually did have progressive systems are in a much better position. So much so that, in my opinion, it's an enviable position. It would be crazy to not have a progressive system. I will not get off of that. But the natural next question is, if you really believe what I say, the question is, well, how progressive does a system have to be truly progressive? And in my opinion, if you compare the systems of the 80s and 90s, where oil prices had for such a long time average $18 a barrel plus or minus $2 a barrel, and here we are at a time where oil prices are three times as high, the truly progressive systems, at an absolute minimum, government take increased 5%, but I think the average is closer to 10%. But I don't have real hard, fast statistics. I've got a lot of good experience and a lot of good indications. I think that's an area where we need to legitimize whatever type of sliding scale or progressive element we might design. If that's the way Alaska chooses to go, then we need to know what the boundary conditions are, what the ranges are, and what the benchmarks are, and that's some work that is going to be required. And so that's one of the things I'm going to be looking for. There must be a fair division of profits, and that's been my mandate, and that's, you know, fairness is something that everybody has an opinion on, and I guess we'll spend the rest of the day talking about that. And there must be no unhealthy disincentives if we can help it, and hopefully it'll be simple and transparent. One critical issue centers on whether or not raising or lowering taxes has an effect on the investment activity in the petroleum sector, and I'm going to address some of the things that were said by others who have testified before me in these hearings, because some of the things that they said, I think, are terribly misleading, and we need to get on the right track on that so that people in Alaska don't feel that we're going to destroy the industry, and they don't think that we're going to, you know, ruin their jobs. Nothing that I've seen so far indicates to me that in any way that this is a real and constant threat, certainly not with the system as it's proposed right now. In fact, I expect quite the opposite. It would take a dramatic reduction in oil prices, perhaps, to really cause problems. But the system as it's designed right now wouldn't be the problem, in my opinion. Every country is unique. Is Alaska more unique? Every country I've ever been to thinks they're the most unique, and they are. There are no two countries that are the same. Every country has its own unique boundary conditions, concerns, and objectives. And then in the context of that, the hand they're dealt, they have to develop policy, strategy, and tactics to compete worldwide for the exploration capital and the development capital that they feel that they need. I just missed a few of the key boundary conditions here, and everybody here appears to me is intimate with the problems that Alaskans face. The top of the list, and appropriately so, is the fact that you're a landlocked country as far as the Arctic slope is concerned, and the high transportation costs associated with that. And then, of course, just the ordinary high cost of operating in the Arctic, even if you weren't landlocked. And the field size distributions are the expectations of the oil companies and even the government geologists indicate to me that we're not in the kind of realm where the oil companies are expecting the potential for giant oil discoveries. In my opinion, exploration in the northern Alaska is certainly not the kind of place that even the majors would be interested in. Perhaps a few. Most of them, they're looking for big reserves, and they're just not as big as I think they need to be to attract that kind of capital. But when it comes to perhaps slightly smaller accumulations, independent oil companies have done good work around the world. In fact, to a large extent, they're the lifeblood of exploration in many places, and the success stories are found all over the world, and I think that they do a good job. Sometimes they accidentally find something that's too big for them to develop, and they get some help from some of the larger companies. It's a formula that has worked for years. Most of my life has dealt with contract design. I plucked this graph on page 11. I call it the balance sheet, and it shows the various elements that constitute the balance between cost, activity, and contract terms. On the left, I list such things, and it's got a lot of question marks on it. I think the formatting between my computer and Mary Jackson's computer, there's a little something different there. I don't think anybody have a problem with that. And again, appropriately so, top of the list, expected field size distributions. How big are the possible targets that we might be drilling for? That's just a very, very important aspect of exploration and development. The petrophysical characteristics of the rock, porosity, permeability, things like that, very important. The delivery weights of an oil well, that's one of the first things I always ask. You know, what kind of test rates and what kind of production rates? What kind of success rates in the area? And that's a function of a variety of things. Is the province gas prone or oil prone? And what's the quality of the oil and or what's the quality of the gas? All of these things. Exploration drilling costs, one of the first questions I asked when I got here, because that thing will characterize a lot the risk side of the equation, the thing that oil companies face when they have to go out and really finally drill a hole in the ground. When you have a feel for the exploration drilling costs, often too, you have a feel for the reward side of the equation, how much it's going to cost in the event that they do perhaps make a discovery, because drilling costs for oil in this world typically represent about a third of the total costs associated with development. The other two components are the production facilities and the transportation function. Exploration drilling usually costs a little bit more than subsequent development drilling, but at least it provides some insight. And then, of course, we get down to transportation costs. Now, and lastly, perhaps that should be at the top of the list, but we're sorting that out, and we'll discuss that. And there's an analytical technique that the administration's consultant, Dr. Pedro Van Uris, used that I think is delightful, and it really does help place Alaska on a better basis by using that analysis. You hear us call it tidewater analysis. I have a table that will help give you a feel for what that's all about. At the bottom of the list, but sometimes it should be at the top of the list, is political risk. To try and quantify and characterize and capture the essence of all that captures the prospectivity side of the balance sheet here is very difficult. It's difficult to do with cash flow analysis alone. It's difficult to do calculating rates of return. It requires more. But we take the art as far as we can, and then we apply what some people might call gut feel, instinct, whatever. And all of these things people become intimate with here in Alaska, and I'm trying to catch up and learn just how things work around here. On the other side of the equation, of course, is the contract terms. What kind of terms might we expect? Now, before I start through the list, you'll notice it's in the middle of this list of about 12 elements that we have the statistic government take. And almost everybody that's testified so far has talked about government take. And we haven't heard much about many of the other elements. The important thing right now, and we'll talk more about it later, there are weaknesses to these government take statistics, and one you can see right here. It doesn't take into account a whole lot of other things. You can have two countries, each with a government take of 65%, which is probably close to world average right now, but the terms for one might be dramatically better than another. Just because they each get an equal share of the profits, sometimes the governments take their profits so far up front and they have so many other elements, they cause extreme financial pain when another country with a similar government take might be much more benign. What type of system? This is very important to oil companies. And as I go down through this list, and I'm going to do it quickly, I want you to think in terms of Alaska. I'll try to give you a little bit of a feel. Most of the provinces of this world with the kind of field size distributions that you have here and the kind of reserves that oil companies and explorers might expect use production sharing contracts. So in answer to the question, what type of system, if you say production sharing contract, there are almost immediate implications that are unfavorable to the oil companies and a few implications that are heartwarming. The most important, though, in my opinion, is to a large extent, It means that the oil company will be entitled to lift fewer barrels. They won't be able to report to their shareholders as many barrels as they otherwise would. So in that respect, they would prefer, typically, royalty tax arrangements like that found here in Alaska. The work program and the seismic data and the drilling and that sort of stuff, some governments require very aggressive drilling programs. Some governments are much more lenient. Timing, relinquishment, and guarantees. That's an area where Alaska distinguishes itself and fairly significantly. Unlike so many other parts of the world, in Alaska, oil companies are able to hold on to substantial acreage that in most other countries they wouldn't be able to hold. And I think it's one of the reasons why the bargaining position of Alaska now is not as strong as it perhaps could be. And it's something to consider for the future, especially if we think in terms of enhancing, hopefully, the bargaining position and the position of your grandchildren. Royalty rates. If, when you have the royalty and the severance tax together, you have fairly high royalty rates by world standards, but royalties aren't the only things that do what royalties do, in which case you were about average. By changing the severance tax to a PPT as proposed by the administration, you're taking that royalty and reducing it down to just the basic 12%, which is not bad by world standards. You don't have a cost recovery limit, and there's no need to discuss what that is. The effective royalty rate is something that takes all of the mechanisms in a country and reduces them down to what we here in Alaska would consider to be a royalty rate. On average in this world, right now, in this day and age, I think a good working number would be about 20%. Governments are guaranteed about 20% of the production in each and every accounting period, or the revenues, regardless of profitability. Many governments feel they need that guarantee. Those types of things are regressive, no doubt. Entitlement is the issue of lifting entitlement, how many barrels the company is physically, legally able to lift and report to their shareholders for all practical purposes. Savings index is something that we will actually talk about, but we'll use different terms later on when we talk about the effect of credits. Ring fencing is a huge term, and it's extremely important for all Alaskans right now, and it's a term you'll hear more and more, because one of the things that is proposed here with the tradability of the credits, and I'll describe all these elements later on, is an issue that most of us in the international end of the industry refer to as ring fencing. As far as world standards go, you're proposing the Cadillac of ring fences, one of the best in the world, rivaled by a few. The closest is, as Dr. Van Uri said the other day, in Norway. Crypto taxes is kind of a cute term. I borrowed that from another author years ago. He was talking about something slightly different, but it applied perfectly to our situation. In some countries, you might have a government take of 70%, no problem, but they hit you in so many other ways with all kinds of things that are so difficult to really quantify, but they do cause the oil companies financial pain and considerable grief. And the list of items is quite long, but I think it wouldn't be worth our while to go through them, because I don't think Alaska really qualifies as far as crypto taxes is concerned, as a real high-risk country. And then, of course, the catch-all, any consultant likes to throw in the other, just in case I forgot things. The next, of course, and if not potentially at the bottom of the list, contract stability. Companies are concerned about that. I don't blame them, and it's an important part. We're getting ready here, or at least it's proposed, contract stability that would be even better than a Cadillac, I guess, Rolls-Royce stability terms is what's being asked for and or demanded by the oil companies. Be very, very careful. It just scares me to death. Now, allocation strategy, or the allocation system that's used, that's the means by which you allocate licenses to the oil companies, and you use what we in the industry refer to as area-wide leasing. It's about as painless as it gets for oil companies. Other companies, the way they allocate their licenses caused the oil companies considerable grief and placed them into extremely competitive situations. The point I'm trying to make is that we're focusing an awful lot on government take, but in the back of your mind, there are a variety of issues where Alaska actually does look quite good. They're difficult to quantify. Some of them we will quantify. But Alaska has got some advantages in addition to some of the drawbacks that we have to deal with, the heavy boundary conditions. Now, we've seen the presentations by the administration, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and British Petroleum, and almost everybody has their own group of countries that they compare Alaska to for the purpose of demonstrating what they feel is fair. You have to do that. It's very important. It's not easy to do. In fact, it's extremely difficult to do. It's particularly difficult for you because of your unique situation. The petroleum profits tax, or proposed profits tax as proposed by the administration, is trying to create a situation where they can accommodate the legacy assets up at Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, and the Arctic frontier exploration, which is just two different animals. They're very, very different. And it's hard to find a peer group where countries are trying to accommodate a situation like that in the way that you are trying to accommodate the disparity of provinces like the two I mentioned in Cook Inlet, for example. I have a problem with some of the peer groups that have been used. And the first problem is the United Kingdom. I don't think there has been a single company, and even the administration, that has not used the United Kingdom as a glistening example of a country that you should compare yourself with. And they all talk about a government take of 50%. But there's another government take in the United Kingdom, and it's fairly well known and widely published, for the old legacy fields like Forties and Brent. The government take there is 75%. In my opinion, for frontier exploration in Alaska, a 50% government take might be a more appropriate country to compare with. It would need a few others. But for the legacy assets up on the North Slope, where I think most people feel that economic limit factor formula has failed, in particular, I think probably a better comparison would be the legacy assets of the United Kingdom, with a government take of 75%. And that's not appropriate to just stop there. We need to do more of these types of analyses. Another one that comes to mind, everybody has talked about Angola. But Angola has a similar situation up in the Cabinda Enclave. The government take in the Cabinda Enclave, I hesitate to guess. I'll tell you this, I know it's more than 75%. No problem. You need to know that. Alaska is different enough, your circumstances are unique enough, that you may not ever expect, and you might not consider it reasonable to expect a 75% government take. But at least you need to know, and we need to work on providing better examples. You've got a two-dimensional, or a bimodal distribution here, and we're trying to compare one peer group with two different situations. It's like a left-handed glove for a right-handed duck. Now, we have another problem, and it's a big problem for me, and I think it's going to be a bit of a problem for everybody else, because I've talked about government take, and I've mentioned the word about 13 times so far, and I've mentioned the fact that there are weaknesses, and we'll go through those weaknesses one by one before this day is over. But there's the part of the problem, though, is how people calculate government take. I saw the problem in a big way first during the ConocoPhillips presentation. They used the Wood Mackenzie report, 2004, that has been quoted so much and referenced here in Alaska. And in fact, long before the ConocoPhillips presentation the other day, which I thought was quite good, and some of those people I quite like and have known for a long time. But the Wood Mackenzie report, if you look at it, explains that when they calculate government take, which, remember, is an effective tax rate, they exclude one of the four main means by which governments get a piece of the pie. And it's called government participation. Government participation works like this. About half of the countries in this world have this option, that if an oil company makes a discovery, and the discovery is considered to be commercial, at the point of commerciality, the government has the option to back in, we say, or take up a working interest. Some people call it a risk-free government carry. It causes the oil companies financial pain, and they hate government participation. They absolutely hate it, and I don't blame them. It reduces the piece of the pie. It reduces their ability to book barrels and report to their shareholders, you know, how glistening their finding costs are. It also means that in their technical committee meetings and the operating committee meetings, the government is going to be involved, and the government will probably chair the management committee. It's like having your mother-in-law living with you. It really is. And so, like I say, and oftentimes it's inefficient because the government people just see things in such a different way. And here we have this thing that causes such financial pain, and is so important. Over half the countries in the world have this option. Those countries that have the option, when they do, it's typically around 30%. Ouch. And yet, the Wood Mackenzie report excludes this in their analysis. Now, by the way, I have considerable respect for Wood Mackenzie, and it's a shame that they're not here to explain and rebut what I have to say, and I feel terrible about that. And I have some wonderful friends there, and I have hold them in very high regard. I think it'll be worthwhile for us to allow them to have their hearing at some point. Regardless of what they have to say, you need to know that this is part of what's going on. I have an example that I'll show you later on. We won't spend a lot of time with it because all the arithmetic is there. I'll just show you where it is. The bottom line is this. If you take the government participation element and factor it into the government take statistics worldwide, it would probably take the world average government take from the Wood Mackenzie report and add 5 percentage points to it. I've seen the comparisons between government take worldwide and how Alaska ranks. I wonder how Alaska would look if you all of a sudden added 5 percentage points of government take to everybody else, because Alaska doesn't have government participation. Will increasing the tax rates in Alaska reduce investment? I didn't realize I was going to have to spend so much time dealing with this, but some of the things that were said by the those that were testifying earlier this week or this last week, it was almost a threat. They claimed that increasing taxes was going to reduce investment in Alaska. There would be less production, significantly less production, and the implication is that Alaskans would lose jobs. But this system is designed to both take and give. Does increasing the taxes reduce investment? And on the other hand, do the credits work? Now, on page 14, I have reproduced the graph from the BP presentation of February 28th. And I was shocked when I saw this graph because I've been in the international business for 25 years, and I lived through the 80s and the 90s, and was always aware of what was going on in the UK sector of the North Sea. It's one of the areas and has been one of the most active offshore provinces in the world. It's famous. And as far as the geology is concerned, it's a gorgeous basin. Geologists get all starry-eyed when they think about the UK sector of the North Sea in particular, because the terms were so good for so long. But if you look at this graph, you see that the government take was around 85% until 1993, and then it dropped in that year to 33%. Now talk about a dramatic reduction in taxes. In fact, I've never seen anything quite like it in the entirety of my career. And this is important, because the thesis was, and it says right here at the head of their graph, they say, but lowering taxes will encourage investment. And they show that production increased dramatically, and yet I knew there had been substantial exploration and development drilling in the early years prior to when that tax rate was dropped. So on the following two pages, and there's a lot of numbers, but I think these numbers are fairly good. I show year by year the royalty rate, the supplementary petroleum duty, the petroleum revenue tax, corporate taxes in the UK North Sea, and then what the marginal tax rate is for the old fields and the new fields. Now, by the way, this term marginal tax is marginal take is almost the same thing as government take. It just happened to be handy to use that statistic. I use that statistic in exactly the same way as British Petroleum does, which I'll remind you, British Petroleum, when they use the term marginal take, me, when I use the term government take, and Dr. Ben Muirs uses the statistic in the same way that I do in his report, those are different statistics. We come up with a different answer to the question, what's government take? And then both of us, even though we have differences, have a different answer to the question, what is government take, than that from ConocoPhillips. Over on the far right, I have annual expenditures for exploration and development throughout the years 1974 through 2005. Now, you have to know one of the key weaknesses of the statistics that I provide. I knew that there was something wrong because in the 1980s, the UK sector of the North Sea instituted a policy similar to what's being proposed here in Alaska, a credit system for all practical purposes, even though the government take was 85%. They instituted a credit system in the UK sector of the North Sea, almost overnight became one of the most active offshore provinces in the world. I remember it well. I just can't remember the exact dates. And so I started doing the research, and I find that it might have been even a two-dimensional change during those years, but it kept the investment activity very, very high. The best I could do in the short time allotted to me, because the first time I saw this argument put forth, and Alaskans would have to be afraid and worried that we're going to, you know, ruin investment activity here in Alaska if they look at a graph like this. This graph is misleading. The best I could do from the UK OOC, which I'm not exactly sure what that is, and I'll figure that, find that out for you, was a graph published by the Department of Industries, I think it's called, DTI in the UK. It was a graph that showed year by year operating costs, development costs, and exploration expenditures. Now, it happens, and it was mentioned during the BP presentation, but in 1988, there was a disaster called the Piper Alpha disaster, and it was just a terribly unfortunate disaster on the Piper Alpha platform, an explosion that killed around 168 people. A few survived, but they were mangled terribly. It was a terrible fire. Helicopters couldn't even get within a mile of that platform. And so for the past 5 years, I believe, could have been longer, the industry had to spend an extra £5 billion. And you see in that column, 5 years was deducted £1 billion per year to normalize that. Once you normalize that, and despite that, if you look at exploration drilling, after 1993, it went down. The tax rate, for all practical purposes, you know, read government take, went from 85 down to 33, and exploration drilling dropped off. Now, we don't have all of the story. I've been trying to get more information. You need more information, but you've got more information now than you did last week when that graph was presented. And the development drilling dropped off too, the development expenditures. On the following page, from a similar site for the British UK OOC, UK drilling activity history. The number of wells per year, and you can see that the exploratory drilling was quite high during parts of the 80s. And then 1986, it looks a little bit light, the price crash. And 1991, they started to come off the plateau, but it never really rebounded. Reducing those taxes had little effect. Now, by the way, too, one thing we don't know is the UK sector of the North Sea was maturing at that time, too. It's not as if they ran out of prospects, but we have, in order to exercise due diligence and do our best for the future generations of Alaska, let's try and find out better, and this is a good start, I believe, if, in fact, the reduction or increase in taxes has a dramatic effect. And let me say this. I cannot emphasize more how dramatic a reduction in taxes of 85 to 33 is. Enough of that. The credit plan. What's being proposed is to allow oil companies right up front a direct credit. In addition to that, the credit is going to be tradable, according to the proposal. I think that's a good system. It works. I've seen it in a number of areas. And I provide, as an example, grassroots exploration in Indonesia. If a company drilled a dry hole, they just lost their money. But if the company had acreage and a discovery and they were producing oil, any follow-up drilling in that acreage was eligible for cost recovery and tax deductions, and for all practical purposes, then the government paid for 85% of the dry hole costs if they drilled a dry hole. They also paid for 85% of development costs if they went forward with development. So the companies were only risking 15 cents on the dollar. Now, I'm referring to the standard old contract for oil that prevailed for so many years in Indonesia. You'll notice Indonesia government take was 85%, and by the way, back in the 70s and throughout the 80s, 85% government take was one of the most famous statistics in the world, and yet Indonesia, even though many people accused them of being greedy, continued to sign contracts. And one of the reasons why companies were willing to submit themselves to an environment where they only got 15% of the profit was, on the risk side of the equation, if they made a discovery, some of the pain was taken away. Now, Norway and the administration's consultant, Dr. Van Meurs, has explained quite well that the closest analog we have to what's proposed in this system is Norway, and I agree with him. He's right. In Norway right now, even with grassroots exploration, if you were to drill a dry hole, the government pretends as though you have existing production in the country, and they allow you to deduct it. that they just actually not, you can't deduct if you don't have it. They pretend as though you're allowed to deduct it. They write you a check. It's almost unheard of. But that will hopefully, in part, justify the otherwise fairly large take. Now, you hear government take for Norway of 75 to 78. A 78 would be the government take if we ignored some other allowances, which don't work like credits, they work like deductions, but 75, 78, no big deal there. It's too early to tell. They only instituted the new system, this system I just described in Norway, a couple of years ago. I don't know the exact date. I think it's important that we try to find out. And I think it would be important, too, to find out if, in fact, it has enhanced exploration activity. The problem is, oil prices have increased since that time, too. So it's going to be difficult to really get a feel for just how effective these incentives have been. But I firmly believe we'll be able to tell. And I think that's very important because Norway is a pretty high-cost environment. And there's parts of Norway that in terms of costs would rival many areas in Alaska. I mentioned the UK system in the North Sea, and there's another aspect of the UK system in the North Sea in the mid-1980s. As I recall, companies were really drilling with only 25 cents on the dollar because of the incentives that were provided. But the government take was 85%. When Representative Samuels asked the British Petroleum representatives if there were any other factors, if there was something else that might have contributed to that dramatic increase in production, they said no. Let me tell you this. The way it worked in the North Sea is you couldn't take advantage of this credit. I'm calling it a credit. Let's go ahead and use that. You couldn't take advantage of that credit unless you had sufficient production against which to apply the credit. So companies had to quickly scratch around and buy production so that they could obtain full coverage for these credits. And the British Petroleum operated Forties field. They started selling what we called back in those days Forties units. Typically 0.25% to 0.5% working interest, non-floating working interests in the Forties field so that they could take full advantage of any exploration drilling that they wanted to undergo. And the ownership in the Forties field almost tripled overnight, overnight meaning 2 or 3 months. There were 12 working interest partners, as I recall, at the beginning of this incentive program. It was upwards of 28 or 30 within just a very short while, which illustrates two things, by the way. One, these credits work, but also, if you're not expecting it, the industry is going to find a way to soak it all up. And sometimes you create something new, there's going to be a way to soak it up and take full advantage of it. And sometimes you hope that that's what's going to happen. Sometimes you didn't expect it. And that's why none of us are sleeping well at night. Canada is another example. In the late 70s, in the early 80s, the Canadian government had a system called the PIP grants. PIP stood for Petroleum Incentive Payments, and as I recall, and I was working with Dome Petroleum at the time as a consultant, they were really only risking 20 cents on the dollar. And that's what justified all the high-risk exploration drilling up in the Canadian Arctic. And those wells up in the Canadian Arctic, as I recall back then, were $80 to $100 million a barrel. Now, even back then, even now, $80 to $100 million is an awful lot of money, even if you factor in the fact that it's Canadian dollars. And I don't remember what the government take was, but it was quite high. We need to find out. I think it would help. What I want to show you here, too, and I'm about ready to carry on, is what's proposed by the PPT, it looks to me like something on the order of 39 cents on the dollar is risk with exploration. In my opinion, I think we could probably go lower if you really want to incentivize exploration for explorers in Alaska. And part of the justification, though, of course, is on the left side. You see 20 cents, 25, 22, 15. But look how it corresponds. Look at the government take that they correspond with fairly high government takes. In my opinion and in my experience, I've seen some fairly high government take. By the way, that's not to say that we should expect dramatic high government takes in the Arctic. The Arctic is fairly different still than even in all of these places. Now, finally, an hour into this presentation, we're going to talk about the system itself. And I don't think I need to take an awful long time because I provided a graph that captures much of that, the flow diagram, because until, for me, I'm able to get a feel for the hierarchy of arithmetic and just where all the dollars go, I really don't feel as though I have an understanding of a fiscal system, and it took a while to get to the point where I was intimate enough that I felt I could publish something like this. It's three pages from here. Basically, the system consists of five components, and many people have gotten confused, and there's a lot of funny things said about it, and it took me a while to figure out just exactly how this thing works, and I'm supposed to be some sort of an expert. So we have the petroleum profits tax, or the proposed profits tax rate of 20%, and what's the tax base? Company cash flow. Now, I always ask, what's the rate, what's the base? And that's true of the means by which governments get a piece of the pie. It's also true of the means by which governments provide incentives. Now, that's the next one. The tax credit rate is also 20% with what's proposed. And what's the tax? What's the basis of that tax credit? My understanding is capital expenditures. Now, some people say, well, it's just a wash. You take 20 and give 20. No, the company cash flow is going to be greater than capital expenditures, or they would never make the capital expenditures. The cash flow should, and typically will, outweigh the capital expenditures 4 or 5 to 1, depending on oil prices. So it's not a wash. But with the expenditures, with a statutory or a notional tax of 20%, with the tax credit, the effective tax that will be paid by the companies will be less than the full 20%. Personally, considering the boundary conditions that the administration was faced with, or self-imposed, I don't know. If you're going to try to create a system that does all things for all people, that accommodates all of the circumstances, the diverse circumstances here in Alaska, I really don't know if you could structure the system any differently. That's my problem. And that wouldn't get you all the way there. Now, the next step, and somebody referred to this as a credit too, in fact, in the report, in February 14th, 2006, it was described a little bit differently, and PBM stands for Dr. Pedro Van Uyres. He says a loss in any year can be converted in a tax credit by taking the 25% tax value. He says 25% tax value because that was in his report where he recommended a 25-20, and I should have put a note there. What this thing really is, at least it helped me to get a better understanding of what this element is, it's simply a tax loss carried forward, except that you can trade it. And so it's a very ordinary thing, except for the tradability of that particular element. So there's nothing really cruel and unusual about that aspect. It just happens to be tradable, and personally I think that's a good thing rather than a bad thing, as long as the rates are right, both in terms of the credits and in terms of the taxes. The base allowance rate, the $73 million deduction, some people inappropriately so call this the standard deduction. That's what it is. It's the toughest of all. I know why it was designed that way. It was a solid and sincere attempt to try to take some of the pain away from explorers and people in places like the Cook Inlet. It's a different beast, and I've never seen anything quite like it. And I think from what you've heard me say so far, you can imagine that makes me squirm. And then the transition provision that was negotiated. Past expenditures from July 2001 to 2006 would be amortized over 6 years and deductible for tax calculation purposes. So whatever that dollar amount is, you multiply times the tax rate, and that is what the industry is asking for. Now let's talk about the various elements. As far as the proposed structure, The 2020 aspect first, we'll talk about the allowance later, and the look-back provision, as we've been calling it. The proposed structure shifts some of the risk from the industry to the state of Alaska, and furthermore, the shift is multidimensional. I think it's important to list all of these things. By shifting the tax base from net production in the past to profits, it takes some of the risk away from the oil companies and puts the burden on the government, because before they were guaranteed a certain amount. Afterwards, they take some risk that there might not be as many profits. And some people, I've heard presentations and their testimony before the House here, refer to these things as a proxy for profits, and almost as if it's disparaging. I think the reason they call it a proxy for profits is simply that no depreciation is required. Well, there's quite a few places in this world that do not require depreciation for tax calculation purposes. It is slightly unusual, so it's a good thing. Oil companies like that. It's not spectacular. By applying the credit to both exploration and development, by allowing credits to be traded, by providing the $73 million allowance, and the added virtue of many of these elements is you can tax deduct or trade. It's almost as if there's no ring fence. There's no tax loss carry forwards. Everything is immediately sorted out. What do I think about the $73 million allowance? Geez. I'm glad it's the legislators that are going to someday have to explain that to the citizens of Alaska, because it's not that I disagree with it. I just don't have my arms around it yet. I don't know how that thing is going to behave ultimately. I want to look at the language very carefully and how it's going to work. I'm just sick about the fact that I can't come up with an alternative, considering the boundary conditions that were placed on Dr. Van Uris and the people he was working with, Roger Marks and those guys. And I don't think he pulled the number out of the air. I think he, you know, legitimately tried to figure out the right thing to do and then did some modeling to see just what kind of, how it behaved. But it is awkward, and it's difficult, and it's complex. And you know, I'm still uncomfortable with it. And like I say, if I come up with a better recommendation, I'll let you know. What do I think about the look-back provision? Remember, my mandate has been to be fair, and in all fairness, I have to admit, there is some fundamental and solid economic logic and reasoning behind the look-back provision. And the logic is, and many of you have heard it, you need to hear it again, these guys made investments for the past few years, and they made those investments with the understanding that we have a deal, and the tax system is going to work a certain way, and now we're making a change. Perhaps you could take some of the pain out by giving us a look back. And the natural rejoinder, of course, is, and I don't blame people, well, what about us? We're not getting a fair shake. This is the Alaskan speaking. We're not getting as much revenue from the system as we should have. How about we do a look back too? Well, if we want to go down that route, it's going to be very difficult. I don't think it's going to be politically easy to sell that to the public, but I'll say this, in the spirit of fairness and the fundamental economic logic, it doesn't hurt as much now as it did on first blush. The first time I heard of it, I was just shocked and sickened. I still don't like it terribly, but I think I've said enough about that. Page 21 is a flow diagram that shows where all the money goes, and we can spend a lot of time going through this. I just would prefer to wait until later if somebody really wants to put me through that. What I've done is this, and the reason I feel I don't need to go through that right now is I think I've got sufficient information on this table here to answer any question you might ever have. Every single number, I believe, is justified. We start out with 20 million barrels at $50 a barrel, and you get $1 billion of revenues. And so at the very top, the 1,000 M stands for 1,000 with me. Some parts of the world, M stands for million. 1,000 million in gross revenues, that's $1 billion. And then we start subtracting all of the things that make Alaska and make this system what it is. Now, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to turn the page now. This issue of progressivity and regressiveness, page 21. I have three relatively simple calculations of government take, calculation A and calculation B, to show simply for a typical system in this world with a 50% royalty and a 50% tax. It doesn't necessarily emulate Alaska. But I want to show what we mean by a regressive fiscal system. And I know it's an insult to some of you who are already intimate with this, but it's important that we do this. And I feel that there's sufficient information here that Alaskans could get a hold of this and walk through this and be fairly comfortable with it. This is how it works. I show with the calculation A that government take is 63%. We have $20 a barrel. With calculation B, government take is the oil price is $60 a barrel instead of 20, and government take goes down from 63 to 59. Now, the government is going to make a pile of money at $60 a barrel, no doubt. A lot more than they would have, and you can look at the actual numbers, the dollar numbers, but nevertheless, the heart and soul and the foundation of taxation theory and the way that most governments feel is, yeah, they're making more money, but perhaps they should have had even more. It's not a comfortable feeling, to see a situation like we've seen in the past 5 years, and your share of the profits went down. That's particularly true if you already felt that perhaps your share of the profits wasn't sufficient anyway. Now, if we go one step further, and that's column C can be viewed a couple of different ways. I use $40 a barrel. It could be viewed as the difference between $20 a barrel and $60 a barrel, the incremental increase in oil price, that by definition in this industry is often referred to as windfall profits. But the calculation of what we call in the industry marginal government take, and I'm almost certain that's the usage that we found in the reports from British Petroleum, we assume that there are no costs. Because if you think about it, if you have production today and you're getting $20 a barrel, and then suddenly tomorrow it's $60 a barrel, there are theoretically no incremental costs associated with that $40 a barrel windfall. So the question is, gee, for that windfall, those windfall profits, what share of the profits does the government get? And that's even a lower number. The bigger problem, page 23. I've made another example here with a slightly different fiscal system. A 15% royalty, taxes at 50%, and a government participation of 30%. And I use the same assumptions throughout, except with the ConocoPhillips or the Woodmac statistics, we ignore the government participation element. I include it. And I'll point out that the administration's approach did too, because they only had one country that actually had government participation. It was Azerbaijan. And in Azerbaijan, the government doesn't back in. They actually pay their way from the very beginning. And Dr. Van Meers referred to it as straight up. I know what he means. I use the term heads up. I think that's a more common term in the industry in my experience. When the government is heads up from day one, it's pretty much, from the oil company's point of view, to a large extent, the same as having ConocoPhillips as partner from day one. And you wouldn't think of that as a government take element. So I agree with Dr. Van Meers and his treatment of Azerbaijan, where day one, the government is heads up for 20%, and they pay their way to 20%. But by virtue of that, we don't treat that as government take. And then, of course, the BP marginal take statistic. So if Alaskans are confused, I don't blame them, because you have Daniel Johnston, the administration, coming up with one statistic that yields, the government take statistic dropped below the graph, and we thought we fixed that. We'll have to look at contractor take. Contractor take is different in each case, which means that government take is different in each case. And here's the importance of that. They're fairly significantly different. 2 points difference in government take between these three, and with some countries with higher government participation, the differences can be even more dramatic. There's so much money involved here, and so much money at stake here. If you use the wrong statistic, perhaps, and you're only off by 2 percentage points, that can represent billions of dollars to the Alaskans. Full stop, it's as simple as that. And that's why I show this table here. In the days to come, we're going to normalize these things, sort these things out, and get everybody on an equal footing so that we don't have this type of confusion. Others might be using different statistics, but at least now we all know that the problem has been identified, and perhaps then we can all start speaking the same language a bit. I had lunch with Dr. Van Meers today, and it was kind of fun. I said, you know, Dr. Van Meers, in Azerbaijan you point out in your report that we don't include Azerbaijan because they pay their way 20% and receive 20% of the profits by virtue of that. And I agree with that. And he said, yeah. I said, you know, sounds an awful lot like the PPT 2020. Let me tell you, it's very, very similar. It's extremely similar, but less painful. From an industry point of view, I'd rather have PPT 2020 if that's all it was without all the others. Well, actually, from the industry point of view, I'd rather have all the other stuff too. But if you just had a profits tax of 20% with a 20% credit, you are just about identical to the system described in his report in Azerbaijan. In which case, theoretically, there's a lot of people might have just excluded that. Government take didn't even change. Now, that's not quite right. We know that, but it's something to think about. I show the definition here from the Wood Mackenzie report. In calculating the government take, we have included all elements of the fiscal regime, such as royalty, income tax, PSC, which stands for production sharing contract profit shares, and additional profits taxes. We have not, however, included any cash flow that would be derived by government or national oil company having an equity interest in a field. This is just so important for Alaska. I've referred to this and probably am the most widely published author in the world on this miserable subject. I refer to it as the government participation controversy. It's been around a long time. It's time to sort it out, at least for Alaskans. Everybody else can fight it over for the next 10 years. Alaskans have to come to terms with it. Here's Dr. Van Muir's assessment. Page 26, and I'm feeling I'm pretty close to on schedule. Now, I used yet again another example, but I think you'll begin to get comfortable and familiar with this. And again, something happened with the printing. We only have company take here. No problem. We have all the information we need. I show an example of a world average fiscal system. Now, world average based on my database that was published in 2002, which ain't very up to date, was a government take of around 65%. And you see that on the left. And world average royalty, by the way, is 7%, so I use a 7% royalty. And if you assume that half the countries of this world have government participation and the other half don't, it's slightly less than half, then the weighted average government participation in this world is about 13.5%. So what I want to show is the difference between the two calculations. You calculate government take factoring it in, like I do, or you ignore it, like Wood Mackenzie and ConocoPhillips does, and you get 5 percentage points difference. We only see company take here. There's 5 percentage points difference in company take. Therefore, there's 5 percentage point difference in government take. This graph on note page number, page 27, is a reproduction of one of the graphs used by ConocoPhillips, and it shows on the left side of the scale government take, the y-axis, and on the x-axis, total costs in barrels of oil equivalent. And the government take statistics, as I understand, came from the Wood Mackenzie report, as reported in the Chronicle example. And they had three regression lines showing roughly three categories of countries. But if you factored in government participation, each of those lines would move. Now you notice, and I use a little bit of art here, it's not as scientific as if we feel like we must, we ultimately would be, but they shift up by 5 percentage points, is the point I'm trying to make. You'll notice they don't shift up in parallel. If you're over on the left of the government and up above where the government take is a little bit higher and the costs are lower, those are the countries that are more likely to have government participation, for what that's worth. One of the senators in the hearings asked during that presentation if, with the credit system, didn't that move Alaska over to the left? And the answer was no, it was already factored in. I don't think I agree. The credit system, for all practical purposes, does make it appear from a financial point of view to the oil companies as though their costs are lower. They don't have to put up as much up front. And that's why you saw in the presentations by the administration that with the PPT, you increase the tax, internal rate of return increases.
Wait, Mr. Chairman? Could you explain that page one more time?
It's fine with me because I'm close. Is that okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair and the representative captain.
Yes.
This graph shows what the government take is on the left scale relative to the costs of doing business in a given country, total costs. And so if we have a country like, let's see, we want a high government take like Venezuela. I didn't mean to make a joke there. High government take like Venezuela, but very low cost. High government take like Nigeria, but relatively low cost. In fact, there's often a correlation between low costs, which is a function of, typically, rather large fields where the economy of scale is such that the costs are lower. And then you have, over on the right, where the costs are higher, and typically there's a downward trend, because governments know they can't squeeze as much out of the oil companies when the profitability is not as great. So she's showing how Alaska compares with the universal fiscal systems compared to basis of just these two statistics. And sometimes it's useful and it's very helpful. A lot of consultants do that, and it helps people get a little bit of a feel, but you have to be very careful. And in this particular case, one, the government, the y-axis is artificially off by 5%. But then the senator asked, well, really, though, with the credit system here compared to other countries, it would be almost as if, you know, you could reduce those costs by 20% if you give them a 20% credit. And basically, I agree with that assessment. So all of a sudden, Alaska perhaps doesn't look so painful. But there's bigger fish to fry than that. The next couple of pages I grabbed from my course workbook materials and from a recent article in the Oil and Gas Journal that I wrote in April of last year, the various issues that we're talking about now. So if anybody wants to revisit that. And I will say this, and it's important to be comfortable with this. A government participation of 30% does cause oil companies financial pain, no doubt. But if you were to instead levy a 30% tax, it doesn't quite cause as much financial pain if that's all you look at. And so I show here what the effective tax rate would be relative to the government's participation of 50%. I call it my paynometer. It's a little esoteric, not worthy of
thank you for that.
Our time right now. On page 31, again from my course materials, I show a picture of a statue holding up two torches. To make this point, the guiding lights of fiscal system design are flexibility and efficiency. And what we mean by that is a flexible system that can accommodate a wide variety of circumstances, high prices, low prices, and efficiency, a system that gets a fair share from the government. And the theory is this. If you really do structure a stable fiscal system, read progressive, then the system is likely to be much more stable in the government. If oil prices triple, it's much less likely to want to change the terms. I show from an old report from Petro Consultants, a company that I think over the years, just like Wood Mackenzie, has done marvelous work, a graph that somehow didn't survive the printer. But it shows the typical regressive signature of a fiscal system. And here's how consultants like me, Econ One and Dr. Van Yers, and Petro Consultants do this. When we evaluate systems, we choose a number of different field sizes. Lately, you've been seeing three, 50, 150, 500. And then at least three price scenarios. Now, three field sizes times three price scenarios, that's nine permutations, but also three different cost assumptions. And we do a discounted cash flow analysis on each of those permutations and see what the government take is. And you can see the government take here is regressive. As profitability increases, the government take goes down. Now, the natural question is, well, so what's government take? Is it 100% or is it around 65? Well, nobody's exploring for the trash over on the left where you're going to get a low rate of return. It certainly wouldn't justify your exploration efforts. So if I were to be asked, what's government take for a system like this, I would say, well, it's around 65% for any prospect that would justify your risking your capital. Page 33, a quick look at the universe of fiscal systems around this world. I say this is from my, it's from my database, but it's also in my course workbook. I try as best I can to capture the diversity of systems that exist. But you'll see I put a dot, a diamond, or a plus by those systems in this world that at least have a half a chance of being progressive. Rate of return systems, they've got some heavy baggage, there's no doubt. They've got problems. But when they're well designed, they are truly progressive. Oil prices go up, government take goes up. R factors, it's a fancy name for a payout formula. It just means when the company gets their money back plus a certain amount, then the government take starts to step up. And then I added price-based formulas. There are a few formulas in this world like that that was proposed by the producers a while back where the tax rate would change as a function of oil prices. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of those around the world. I did that by memory here in Alaska, I think it was last week. And you see there's a few of those. If you look at all of the systems that have either one or more than one of those types of mechanisms, it's about 25-30% of the systems of this world that have a chance of being progressive. And then there's a few that are neutral, but still, well over half of the countries in this world are regressive. And let me tell you, all of those guys wish they weren't right now. There's no doubt. Just for the convenience sake, I find myself over and over turning back and referring to some of the graphs from the presentations by Roger Marks and Dr. Van Meers. And so I just put them here for reference for my benefit to a certain extent. I've tried to put everything in one place so that I can, you know, have everything in one place. Page 39, I try to warn people that there's statistics and there's statistics, and then there's economists, and you've got to be pretty careful. But these came from my database, and there's quite a variety of them, some of them that I think you'll find enlightening. On page 40, the weaknesses of the government take statistics. And I think it's important to go through that pretty quickly, but I was shooting for an hour, and I'm almost there. Might go a bit longer. One thing about the government take statistic, it really doesn't very adequately capture signature bonuses. Even with this kind of cash flow analysis, they really don't. You really don't get the full effect and feel the pain that oil companies feel with signature bonuses. Signature bonuses, you have those here when companies bid on acreage in the Gulf of Mexico, they're famous for its signature bonuses. It's just important to know that that's one weakness. The take statistic doesn't measure how the government gets a piece of the pie. You can have one government with 70% take and another with a 70% take, as I mentioned before. They can be entirely different. It doesn't say much of the timing either, or the time value of money. And that's why we have a lot of times, and you see it in the Wood Mackenzie report, which I find quite helpful, discounted government take. And then, too, the macroeconomic scope of this is very narrow, extremely narrow. In fact, it's more of a microeconomic view. It doesn't capture things that I refer to sometimes as gross benefits, and I added this for our benefit, such things as jobs and the multiplier effects of investment in a country. Sometimes governments benefit in substantial ways that go well above and beyond simple government take. And it says nothing of ring fencing, the ability to tax deduct from one area to another, and you guys are contemplating giving the Cadillac of ring fences. And as you go down through all these weaknesses of the take statistic, you find that, gee, you know, yeah, your take might, you know, compare with this country or that, but I wonder how it would compare on many of these other elements. It doesn't measure contract or system stability. You guys are getting accused of an awful lot of things these days in regard to stability. Let me say this, though. It just doesn't look that unstable when everybody is changing their terms. And let me tell you, just about everybody is either changing or considering making changes to their terms these days, in which case, if you're feeling guilty about the work that we're doing here and contemplating making a change, I'd say just relax about that. Doesn't say anything about ownership or booking barrels. And it doesn't differentiate between diverse work program provisions. I was involved in the license round in Burma in 1989. It was a viciously attended license round, much more of a feeding frenzy. And they required the oil companies to spud their wells in a very large drilling program. They had to spud their wells within the first 12 to 14 months. It was very unreasonable. It was just ridiculous. That country has a weather window that almost rivals yours. They say of Burma and Bangladesh, that area, you can tell when the rainy season is over because the rain quits falling like this and only falls like this. And so sometimes you have situations where the government are fairly lenient on work provisions and work requirements and stuff. And I think that to a large extent, compared to many other parts of the world, would describe Alaska. Crypto taxes, by definition, just don't get captured in the take statistic. And to give you an example, I would have to say that Alaska is probably fairly low on the paynometer for crypto taxes, whereas Nigeria would be about as high as you can get in places like that. There are some places in this world where the pain is so great and the risks are so great. In fact, I don't even mention the government's risk here, or what we sometimes call political risk or commercial risk. I think Alaska is one of the less risky places on the planet. There's nobody that is without risk, but if anybody thinks Alaska is risky, I'll give you 25 countries within 13 seconds that are riskier and are significantly riskier. More statistics on page 42, but for those who are contemplating exploring in Alaska, you see frontier terms, and you'll also see, too, a difference between oil and gas, something I haven't addressed yet, because, and I'm not talking about gas pipeline, I'm talking about gas exploration, something to consider. Gas discoveries typically are just not nearly as valuable as an oil discovery for the same volume of reservoir rock. Here's some statistics that I've gathered and kind of plucked from various places and put into my workbook for my course materials. One's from Petro Consultants. What they used to publish over the years, Review of Petroleum Fiscal Regimes, or RFR, Review of Fiscal Regimes. And they were showing deep water terms around the world and what the world average deep, and the world average terms for all systems back then in 1997, 65% government take. And the breakdown, we have 72 of these systems were regressive, 5 were neutral, and 23 were progressive. And if you look at the economic fields, 67% government take. When you get to upside, which was typically a lower cost, higher price, probably not even as robust as the difference between $20 a barrel and 60, but you see 5 full points of increase on the government take there. And a few more frontier regimes where the government take is 60%. Personally, 60% seems a bit rich to me here in Alaska, but there's more work to be done. Page 44. This graph has been extremely popular in this world, and it's been used by so many people. I send it out for free, and I've been sending variations of this out to anybody who wants to use it or abuse it. But usually people know that it's got its weaknesses, and generally people are talking about exploration licenses, although every now and then I run across a development pipe license, West Kerna in Iraq. The terms were so tough I couldn't resist plugging those in. But then, of course, that contract fell through. That was with, I think, Lukoil. And then there was a war, and that contract doesn't exist anymore. But at the time, they carved out some of the toughest terms in the world because it didn't represent an exploration contract. It was a development contract. This universe of terms that you see here is probably fairly close to a statistically significant sampling of just what was going on in the world back in the late 90s, early part of the century. But I don't think it would be appropriate for what we're doing up here. If all we were talking about up here was exploration economics, I would be much more comfortable using a broader universe of terms for a peer group analysis. But we're trying to come up with a peer group that encompasses the legacy assets of the North Slope as well as exploration, as well as Cook Inlet, as well as other places. And so you should be extremely wary of a graph like this. I point out here, by the way, two of the things that help further characterize government take. On the left-hand column, government participation. I factor it in, as you know. But you look down, about halfway down the graph here, Azerbaijan, on either side of Azerbaijan, where they have a 50% participation, are two countries with no participation. And imagine for somebody to exclude a 50% government participation would make Azerbaijan look awfully rosy. This graph here, I think, is fairly representative. I'd be a little bit careful. It was only meant to be representative, and most of it based on cash flow analysis, no doubt about that. But you see the few systems that are progressive, truly progressive, and some a little more progressive than others. But most of the systems in this world, and the colors were supposed to... a little technical difficulty here. The systems who moved to the left are the progressive systems, and there's a few that actually moved to the left, but not very far. The color scheme should have enabled you to be able to see that most of these systems were regressive, and the government take dropped, but it didn't drop by much in terms of dollars and in terms of value, though, with large projects. 1 or 2 or 5 percentage points government take may not sound like much. It could be measured in billions. The guys that are on the left, who moved to the left, their government take increased in some cases nearly 20 points, 10 points, 15 points, 5 points. Don't you know they feel a lot more comfortable today than you do? Enough of that. Contract, page number 46, graph number 3. Please don't consider this to be anything final, nor should we try to draw any major conclusions. I do show the UK and what happened in the UK over the past 5 years, actually 3 or 4 years. I think it was 1992 when they went from 30% to 40%, and in December of last year they went from 40% to 50% government take up on the top, and you see the red line there. Government take during that same period for the legacy fields, Brent and Forties and fields like that, went from 65% up to 75%. And I don't think it's appropriate either to just use that as a comparison for your legacy appeals, but I think we need to maybe give some consideration to that. I'll say this. I couldn't have faced posterity, nor my wife and children, if I hadn't mentioned that the government take in some of those fields in the North Sea are 75, especially after everybody has used that statistic, the other statistic of the government take of 50%. There's a lot of work that needs to be done here. Be very careful. I hope you can see how uncomfortable I am. This thing here, be careful. Graph number 4. Gosh. When I first showed this in a public setting, an oil company guy said, "God, I hope you never show that to government officials." But there's a natural question here, and I hope that nobody thinks that I intend to recommend that you take away all the upside. And I recall somebody said during the hearings that governments love to take away all the upside. I don't think there's anybody in this room that wants to take away all the upside. You just want a little bit more of the upside, and you want a fair share. And there's nothing fairer than that, and I hope I can be of assistance in that respect. But all I ask here is, what kind of terms, all other things being equal, would yield the same economic benefits at $60 a barrel that we had at 20? Well, this happy little graph with all the nice colors on it moves strongly over to the left. Now, by the way, we saw, I used a slightly different graph, it had been updated a bit, and that was in my article about Libya in the Oil and Gas Journal last year. The Libyan license round was rather astonishing, and the company's bid terms that seemed to me to be relatively consistent, with a few exceptions, with this graph here, especially on the high-end government takes of an order of 95% or so. It was just to the oil companies who bid but did not succeed, it was horrifying because they agonized over those bids that they submitted, and they were blown out of the water by the high bidders. Sometimes there were 4 or 5 or 6 bidders that outbid them on those blocks. Some blocks had 15 bids. Feeding frenzies I have known. Contract duration, one thing I want to talk about, and it is consistent to a certain extent with the notion of fiscal stability. Fiscal stability, how long? One of the folks that testified in the hearing said that typically in this world, contracts last about 50 to 60 years. And when I heard that, I was in a bit of a state of shock, so I immediately went to my course materials. I took this right out of the course materials to show what the duration of contracts typically looks like. And typically, contracts are two-dimensional. You have an exploration term that is typically 3 phases or 3 periods, 3 years plus 2 years plus 2 years. And if you make a discovery and enter into the production phase or the development phase, then typically it's 25 years with a lot of variation on that theme, but you almost... I think Brunei on here somewhere, I think, had a 50-year, 38 plus 30, that's 68 years. And then there's another, Brunei Offshore. And by the way, that was old contracts. They've left new contracts recently. I'd be real curious if those contracts were really that long. And that would be the exception rather than the rule. 50 to 60 years is not a good working number. Oh, this is the second round in Libya, which was even more bullish than the first. No time to talk about that. The graph on page 51 simply, I'm so happy to be nearly done. This is an old graph that was developed by a well-known, well-respected guy named Paul Neuendorp, and some people refer to it, at least old-timers like me, refer to it as Neuendorp's two-outcome model. It's a variation on an age-old thing. Dr. Marianne Kaa referred to it when she talked about expected value theory or risk analysis. This is the essence of risk analysis, but most oil companies typically will characterize the reward side of the equation with more than just one point. When you do that, we call that decision tree analysis, and we love to do that in the oil business. Explorers do that all the time. We have to figure out if the rewards can balance the risks, and that's what a graph like this is all about. And so I show the blue line, a situation where an oil company is contemplating drilling a $20 million dry hole. And they feel that the probability of success is 20%. Well, then you just draw a straight line, and the axes on the right and the left, the y-axes, are the same, and they all represent discounted present value. And I believe I use 12.5%, and I don't even say, can you believe that? I do apologize for that. Now, what this tells us then is, in order for them to justify risking $20 million in a given province, the value of the potential reward must be around $80 million. So then they do further analysis to see how big does a prospect have to be worth that much. And it might be, you might require a 200 million barrel prospect or more. So the next natural next question is, okay, for that province, how many of these prospects are, what are the expectations? Do we really believe that there are 200 million barrel prospects out there? Because if they're not, we're not going to go there. Now what you do with the credits, and the credits here nearly cut in half the exploration risk for the oil companies. And what you do then is you go to $10 million of risk capital, cross the line at the 20% probability of success, and you come down, and lo and behold, the prospect size is about half. And hopefully, a fiscal system would be structured, or the credits would be structured, in such a way that the exploration threshold field size is lower or smaller than, you know, the average field size in whatever distribution or whatever, you know, nature of the expectations are for the oil companies. It's got to work right and it's got to be appropriate. And then there was one other thing, one of the presentations on the 28th of February 2006 by BP, and I just have to stop and say, no, let's make sure you get another perspective on this. And I highlighted this, the emphasis was added by me, and you can read it all, but basically the statement was, internationally, production sharing contracts include terms for both oil and gas. General oil and gas tax laws across the U.S. and internationally always address both oil and gas. No. And in the first contract I grabbed was from Angola, and it's, and we get to a clause that some of us in the industry refer to as a gas clause. When other people use the term gas clause, they mean something else. What I mean by that is this: most of the production sharing contracts in the 70s and in the 80s, and even some now, have well-defined terms for oil. They know the royalty rate, the companies know the tax rate, they know the profit all split, and all the financial and fiscal terms associated with what might happen in the event of an oil discovery. But they also know, too, that because of the nature of the province and the distance from marketplaces and how worthless gas can be in some circumstances, that it's probably premature to waste a lot of time crafting contract language and trying to come up with terms that might become obsolete the minute you make a discovery. Now, it's not as true these days, but it certainly used to be more true in the past. Many people were plenty happy to just leave it like this and say, basically this clause here says, okay, now listen, if we make a gas discovery, we'll try and figure it out. And it's like a renegotiation clause. In fact, I consider it a family of renegotiation clauses or reopeners. And sometimes that's about as good as you're going to get. I think you have to know that, in my opinion, still, if I were to go to my database and pick 10 production sharing contracts, I bet at least 30%, probably half at least, would have a clause similar to this. This clause is a little more vicious. It says, if you don't figure something out in 36 months, you might not have an opportunity to mess with it any longer. And there's a lot of variations on this theme. The main thing is to know it just wasn't right to make that statement. It might have been inadvertent, but you need to know whether it was intentionally or accidentally. Always is not the appropriate word to use there. I have a section here that describes ring fencing. It's an issue that goes to the heart of what you're talking about here. Every now and then I keep thinking, what was that economic limit factor formula again? And I found a little file back in my on my machine, and I put it here that just for the sake of completeness. I bet there's an 80% chance that half of you in here can correct this for me. I mostly did it for my benefit, and I'm finished. Thanks for the opportunity, Chairman and members of the committee. I'll be happy to answer any questions if you'd like.
First of all, thank you very much, Mr. Johnson, for your time. What we'd like to do is to get into the questions, and there's two things. We'd like to get a little bit of deference to the Resource and Finance Committee members, because they're going to have to kind of have the first bite at the apple here. And secondly, I'd like to remind everybody of Mr. Alex Trebek. In the form of a question, please. We don't want to convince each other what we think. We want to know what Mr. Johnson thinks. And in that, Mr. Johnson, you kind of punted on the $73 million. If we eliminate the $73 million, do we need to replace it with something else, some sort of tax credit system?
you just cannot replace it. And so that's why I haven't recommended that you do that. I know I'm visibly uncomfortable, but I would be even more uncomfortable if somebody just said arbitrarily, we got to get rid of that thing. That thing won't work for a lot of decent, respectable, hardworking companies in this state. And so, yeah, you just can't wipe it out. It has to be replaced by something. I don't know quite yet. I agonize in the middle of the night every night over that, and I'm sure other people do too.
Yes, I do. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Your reference backing in from countries. Is getting a royalty the same as backing in?
No, not in the language of the industry, but in a way it's a way of backing in, because you know, when a government receives a royalty, the oil companies are paid for everything right up to the point of production, and then the country gets something that they didn't pay for. So you could think of it that way from a financial point of view. In the language of the industry, no, it wouldn't be called that, but from a financial point of view, you could think of it that way.
Second question.
Yes.
Might as well move to the second one. On page 20, you refer to the look back. We've been dealing with this look back at some extent. When you consider that an investment a company made yesterday, then the look back has some real meaning. But if they made the investment 5 years ago, it has a much less meaning, because they've been able to utilize the value of the investment for the 5 years. Would you suggest that we actually consider a look back, but layer it back so that it goes maybe 80, 60, 40, 20, 0, or absolutely just don't look at it at all?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, it is a somewhat complex issue, and philosophically, there are ways of looking at the rationale for, one, how far back, and two, well, what kind of expectations should they have had, and three, the fairness, and four, yes, they've got some use out of it, but that, to me, isn't quite the issue. Their theme is, you know, really, we might look at things differently if we had known that there was going to be a change, and beyond that, I'm still agonizing over that thing too. I'm just simply not comfortable with elements of the look back, because to a certain extent I feel that Alaskans are behind, and that you haven't been receiving as much as you should have because of the inefficiencies of the system, and it's particularly inefficient. In fact, you have more reasons to change than most governments. And so I think it just intuitively bothers me, but I can see some of the logic that they have. And I'm not happy just saying 5 years will allow you to deduct those costs. I apologize, sir. I don't think that's a very good answer, but it's the best I can do at the moment.
Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Brilliant, compelling, interesting, great tutorial. Quick question just regarding your schedule. Are you going? We know you're leaving tomorrow or Wednesday morning. Will you be returning to Alaska? Are you available to us over the next couple of 2 or 3 weeks? And then my question of substance is, here's Dr. Ben Muir's at 2520, and now we're at 2020. What's optimum now that we've covered, you know, this brilliant thing?
Through the chair and Representative for Chairman, Co-Chair Ramos, my availability is a function of a tight schedule. I have 2 weeks available per month for the next 5 months, basically, places to go and commitments. And so there's 2 weeks available per month for the next 5 months. And like Dr. Van Muris, he works in the evenings and weekends when he's on the road. I also have a wife and 6 kids that haven't seen me. I think I haven't even been home 3 weeks this year. I will be available tomorrow, perhaps the next day, but then I'll be so anxious to leave. It's going to kill me. And that answers, I hope, the first question.
Thank you.
And I don't exactly remember the second half of this. I do remember. Well, first of all, what would be correct and appropriate, full stop, is you just have to have a progressive system. I mean, it's the year 2006. Everybody's going that direction, and for good reason. And the basic economic logic is sound as well, because theoretically, and in practice too, I've seen it. It makes the system more stable, and it will make future citizens more comfortable when they know, gee, oil prices went up, and our share of the profits went up too. So there's something virtuous, and there's dignity in that. It ain't going to feel very dignified if we end up with something that's less than, you know, state of the art 10 years from now or 20 years from now, especially in the context of the notion of fiscal certainty. And even if you don't buy into and go as far as the producers want in regards to fiscal certainty, by designing and changing the terms right now is the implication and the assumption that you're going to hold to it for a while at least. And so let's try and make it a stable and comfortable system. As far as the starting place is concerned, it's not real easy because we've got the legacy production on the North Slope, and then we've got Cook Inlet. And Cook Inlet is just, you know, those platforms got 90% water cut, and they've already shut in a couple, but, you know, $60 a barrel is going to help. But Cook Inlet is just not, does not need more pain.
Let's exclude Cook Inlet.
Okay, can we exclude a few other things too? It's premature for me to answer that right now. My gut instinct and everything I've seen so far, I just am not happy with 2020. And I think a lot of people know that. 2520 is a starting point, and then it's got to be progressive from there. But is that 2520 at $60 a barrel? Well, Daniel, what if oil prices go down to 40? Or 30? Or 20? Well, that progressive sliding scale may opt to accommodate that, but I feel that Alaska should be in a position where they don't have to risk so much that they feel additional pain. You're not getting as much money as you should be getting. I firmly, strongly believe that. And if we structure a sliding scale, and that means it's going to have to be a sliding scale of somewhat, that's what I've said all along, and I've looked into it. We got to structure it with care. Many sliding scales just don't work real well. But some do. There's no doubt about that. Then the last thing, too, is, it's, in my opinion, it's nearly impossible. I can't quite even think in those terms generally. If we could exclude Cook Inlet and exploration on in Alaska and focus just on the legacy fields, and then I could, with much greater comfort, come up with the logic and the rationale, justification for a fair and reasonable rate appropriate for that circumstance and those conditions. But when we stand back and try to make this thing work for, you know, everybody, it just is a mess.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. If we exclude Cook Inlet, but we treat the rest of Alaska as a composite with a one-saddle-fits-all size, what happens if, in our model, the exploration is several percentage points higher than the tax rate? Does that queer the soup, or is it good for the process? Is it good for those that choose to explore? What?
So, yeah, I think, you know, if it depends on oil prices, but I'll say this real quickly. It doesn't matter what we think oil prices are going to be. In fact, to a certain extent, for a guy like me, it doesn't matter what my opinion of what oil prices are. We should try to design a system that can accommodate a real wide variety of prices, no doubt. And that kind of logic and approach would have helped in the past, but at least we're doing it now. Personally, I think if oil prices stay at 60 and go up, you know, we won't have to worry too much. But if for the downside, we need to structure a way that perhaps it encourages exploration. If Alaskans want exploration, then you're going to have to make it less painful. And I'd like to see greater credits for exploration. And you just have to structure it so that you could. The natural question is, you know, do you want to double the rate of exploration? Do you want to triple it? Or do you think it's a waste of time? Depending on which answer, then you structure the system accordingly.
Thank you. I've got Representative Ledoux, Kapsner, Holmes, Seaton, Kelly. Representative Ledoux.
Well, this is probably a little bit of a follow-up on Representative Ramros's questions. But if this were totally up to you. You were elected emperor as far as this thing is concerned. And your only consideration is what is going to bring the most money into the state of Alaska over the next 25 or 30 years, and also what is going to facilitate exploration. And your only political consideration is you don't want to do something to make the oil companies pack up and go home. What system would you recommend?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm glad you added that last part to that question. I would try as best I could. Well, you'd have to get rid of all the LARCs because it's a legal issue. If I could do what I'd like to do, I'd like to just treat various provinces in a different way. And many countries do. We see the bigger fields, the older fields in the United Kingdom that receive a higher tax rate than the smaller, newer fields and stuff like that, because they're just so different. So I would structure the system in such a way that we could just really truly segregate the different classes of investor, because that would have to be better, it seems to me, than trying to use that magic $73 number, because that is the thing that really makes the difference.
And could we, is it your understanding that we're prohibited legally from doing that here in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, thank goodness I'm not a lawyer. I don't know, but some discussions intimate that perhaps that might be the case, and I think, oh, please, perhaps we can fix that. Because if that's the case, that legally you can't, then you're forced to try and do what Dr. Van Meurs has tried to do, and maybe he's more comfortable with it than I am, but no, it's a very uncomfortable situation right now for me.
Representative Kastner.
Thank you. On the topic of tax credits and in regard to the 20% tax credit on the look back, I'm wondering if you would recommend that we focus our attention on true exploration costs rather than allowing credits for development of fields that have already been explored.
Chair, Representative Kastner. You know, there's some good logic there, and every now and then there have been a few people who their acid test for issues like that always are we incentivizing the thing that we want to incentivize? Now, if it's exploration, and it's exploration that you want most, then you focus on that, and perhaps you might not allow as a larger credit for development expenditures, or maybe none at all. You have to differentiate if you're going to make a distinction between the category of investment that you want. In my opinion, though, and I heard it from one of the British Petroleum guys when he said they're going to explore within their own fields. And what he meant by that was, imagine they're contemplating a water flood, and it's going to cost $100 million to just, you know, run a pilot. And a pilot study means they're going to drill a few wells and, you know, a certain pattern and inject either water or something in some of the holes and see if they get the kind of reservoir response that they need to justify going through with a full-blown development. After having spent $100 million and a couple of years evaluating the results, they might find that just didn't work. In my opinion, that would qualify as exploration expenditures, and that's the kind of investment that's very healthy, too. I would want to encourage that kind of investment. And especially, almost by definition, if you're contemplating investments like that, you're talking about the relatively lower profitability, higher risk stuff than ordinary development. And in fact, that's a huge part of the future here is there. As far as the pie is concerned, most of the action is the existing fields and the existing production. And next is what I've just described, exploration within those fields. And next after that is wildcatting, frontier exploration, as far as the dollars to the state of Alaska. I hope that answered your question, Mike.
Okay. Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here, Mr. Johnson. It's been most enlightening. How strong is our bargaining position in light of the fact that we don't negotiate these contracts, and we're, I mean in terms of the legislature, and in light of the fact that we don't want to create a situation that's negative with regards to keeping oil in the line, do we have any control over whether they lift or don't lift, and how important is that going to be in terms of our negotiations?
Through the chair, Representative Palmer. It's a bit of an uncomfortable question because it's a very sensitive issue and goes to the heart of sovereignty and things. Your bargaining position is more a function of just how much strength Alaskans have and not quite as much a function of who's doing the negotiating. Now, unless you're asking what's the legislators, what is the legislature's bargaining power? I was thinking in terms of the bargaining power of the state government, whether the administration or the legislature, or the combination of the two, because ultimately it is going to be the combination of the two. When it comes to this particular issue, it's one of the most widely published subjects in the world, and you find yourself in a similar position to many countries where the mineral resources have a huge contribution to the nation's budget. In fact, I think Alaska is number one in the United States where oil revenues have the greatest contribution, and my old home state, Wyoming, is second. And invariably, almost by definition, the strength and lobbying power of the companies is the greatest in countries like that, full stop. Not that it's an evil thing. I met some of the first lobbyists I've ever met my whole life in the past few weeks, and I think there's virtue in having lobbyists, but I know there's a downside to that, too. You're not in the strongest position I've ever seen as a state, and that scares me, and I'll be happy to quit talking about that. And I have forgotten the second half of your question, sir.
That's okay. I just meant in terms of whether or not we could walk away. I guess that's what I'm alluding to. Normally, when I've done negotiations and been involved in negotiations, one of the things you do is you have a drop-dead piece. They say, no, we're not going to go any further than this. And I guess I'm a little uncomfortable sitting here, and I think all of us are figuring we don't really understand where that line is drawn or if there is such a thing as a line.
Through the chair, Representative Holm, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I believe that in certain circumstances, it's excellent, you know, tactics and consistent with appropriate strategy. Your problem is, as far as these oil negotiations are concerned, walking away from the table just means that the disparity in the revenues you should be receiving relative to what you are receiving just continues to mount up. And we get our pencils out and do a little arithmetic. You walk away from the table one day, one week, one month, it's just lost money. It's a lot of lost money.
Thank you for that. Mr. Chairman, can I have one
yes.
more? Mr. Johnson, you talked about the difference between giving a check and you alluded to it, giving a check rather than giving a credit, a saleable credit or something like that. Could you comment as to whether or not which is most advisable to do and which is most, what's going to energize the smaller explorers into the field versus the big boys?
Through the chair, Representative Holm, they're virtually identical. And from the oil company's point of view, they would see it as an immediate reimbursement of some percentage of their costs, because with the credits that's been proposed here, they would be able to sell them, and not dollar for dollar, but for all practical purposes, they would be able to sell them, which is tantamount to getting a check.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, the contract or the bill that we have before us puts together oil and gas, and, you know, you expressed some concern about that and the complexity of it, and I'm trying to find out, figure out, not talking about North Slope, a gas line, but talking about putting in the PPP gas and oil together. Does the complexity that's added by having gas in there and the analysis that requires for this tax, does that outweigh the benefit of having the
gas and oil together? In other words, should we take gas out of this mix in this tax bill if we're to understand it on oil, or should we leave it in?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's sure for me to expand at length on that because of ignorance. I don't know enough about that situation to say yet. My discomfort initially was, I thought when people talk about gas, they're talking about the gas. But that is going to influence gas for future exploration. And in many parts of the world, because gas is, you know, if you have a prospect and you don't know whether it's gas or oil, if it turns out to be an oil discovery, that's one thing. If it turns out to be a gas discovery, that's another. Even if you had a well-established market and good price for gas, it's typically worth half as much as oil. So almost always you'd rather have an oil discovery, in which case to try to provide additional incentives for gas exploration. Sometimes countries provide better terms or different incentives. And the minute we go down that path, things start to get different. And with the credit system, there's the potential for some strange uncertainties that are going to require some concentration and thought, which I haven't even started to get to it.
Well, following up, I guess this is one place that's fairly large consideration in the bill. I mean, it's a small piece, basically, but it adds a huge complexity, so when you can give us some feedback on that, I hope you will look at that, because I don't know where to go on.
Representative Kelly.
Yes, good to see you again, Daniel. On the sensitivity, I asked you last time we spoke on this, relative to the tax and the credit, to try to gauge the sensitivity of the two, and you said that the sensitivity on the profit side is probably overshadowed, or that if you went to the credit side, just pick a number that you didn't want to be held to, but you said it may be 10 times as sensitive on the credit side as it is on the profit side of the line. And the question is, if that's the case, and if we've been bounded by, say, somewhere between 20% and 30%, and it is fairly insensitive on that top side, how do we fine-tune the credit side? Second, a couple of other quick questions, and maybe I'll stop here for the first one.
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, it's nice to see you again, too. The working number that I've used, and I still feel fairly comfortable with it, and if we could probably turn to some of the graphs that were generated by Dr. Roger Marks and Dr. Pedro Van Meers, because you can see in those graphs that it's the tax that is the most sensitive. And it's 5-1 is a good working number that I've used. You increase the tax rate by 1%, that'll have as much change as reducing the credit by 5. Some number like that. So the action is in the tax. Much greater part of the action is in the tax, no doubt. And the credits, to a large extent, don't bother me nearly so much. It's the other one that I would focus on more if I'm going to look at the relationship between the two.
Okay, and the safety net, all of the families of curves that everyone shows on the progressive system, which I think is a slam dunk that we're going to certainly go for the progressive system. But those curves all on the bottom, when they come below the elf line, are diving for zero like a rock falling. Would you undergird this progressive system with either a left-in-place elf or something else so that that hits a leveling point before it goes right through the bottom?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, to quote a previous witness, all the numbers are wrong. every one of the runs that people do, it seems, and all the different analyses show different crossover points. We talk a lot about crossover. It's my opinion that with a fair share of the profits, the state of Alaska would be fairly dramatically protected, but that's not enough of a guarantee. I feel that you should draw a line in the sand so that you never do worse than what ELF would have yielded. And so you might come to something where you calculate the tax in two ways. You calculate ELF, and you calculate the new PPT, whatever that might be, and take the higher of the two. That's the way we did it in New Zealand. And that's the way it's done in Newfoundland. There's a few other places. Kazakhstan has three calculations.
Thank you. Thank you. And just one last,
yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, if I might. You referred about three different times to the boundary conditions that were imposed on this, as if to send the message that if you would have preferred if they weren't. What are your three to five biggest boundary conditions here that we ought to be concerned about as a separate branch from the negotiators?
Well, it seemed that one of the biggest boundary conditions was that everything had to be in one system had to fit all. That, in my mind, was the biggest boundary condition, and that's why you don't find me being critical of work by Dr. Van Meers, because he did damn well he had to work with. And he did, and I refer to it as by the numbers. Okay, if these are the boundary conditions and these are our objectives, then one thing, you're going to have a credit system. And he and I both extensive credit systems, and we know they work. No doubt about that. Another one that I didn't even mention today, the credits for gas for coal bed methane, and that's what one of the reasons why coal bed methane is so robust today. Gas prices would have ensured that coal bed methane would be robust, but it might have been a little bit longer. Coal bed methane was a tough sell in the early days, and those credits helped a lot. And then on the reward side, getting a piece of the pie and getting the tax right, that's part of it too. But if you increase the taxes, then all of a sudden there's a class of investor that's important to this, I almost said country, to this state, that start to feel pain immediately, and that's the Kootenai Lake and potential future explorers. And then, two, because the business was that Kootenai Lake couldn't sustain increase in the tax rate, that the allowances might help offset that. And so it was, the 73% is an attempt to truly separate the different provinces, but I'm very skeptical. But like I say, the boundary conditions placed on Dr. Van Meers in the context of the objectives that were also provided almost required him to go that direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I've got Representative Katula, Olson, Berkowitz, Rookberg, and Guy. Representative Katula.
Thanks. I just want to close a few loops so I'm sure I'm understanding. But are you aware of any other country that includes all of the kinds of incentives and credits at once that we're talking about? The tax rate, the reduction, development, exploration credits, the lease expenditures with capital, all in one, you know, right up front, the trading, the transitional provisions, the mixing of your gas, all at once. Anything, any place else that you're aware of just does all of these things? In one, or something like that, all in one fell swoop?
Through the chair, Representative Curtula. No.
That's where the Rolls Royce.
Well, no, you had a few Rolls Royce provisions. You didn't have a Rolls Royce yet, excuse me.
Got a letter on me.
If we can allow incentives
for
the tax rate, and we can allow incentives, and we've got a U.S. Supreme Court case right now, so that's going to be a good question. But if we can, are allowed to break them apart, then your recommendation then is it that we break apart the legacy versus the newer fields that we want to incentivize?
To the chair who represented Curtis, yes, but that's got its problems too, no doubt about that. But in my mind, at least I've got experience and a lot of comfort with countries that do things that way, quite a few. And Pakistan has onshore terms, and then they have Pakistan 1, Pakistan 2, Pakistan 3 terms for different types of areas. Algeria had Zone A, Zone B, and Zone C, as I recall, and you have offshore terms and you have onshore terms. And some countries have some special and different terms for gas than for oil. That's what I'm comfortable with, and that's what I've seen.
Yeah. That was my last question, was... Are you aware of any other country that allows that dollar-for-dollar kind of set-off for the oil or even the gas against the oil or any other mineral, one against the other like that? That confuses me a lot.
Through the chair, Representative Cartula, I think I understand the question. Now, dollar-for-dollar credits, but you're talking about dollar-for-dollar credits from oil expenditures against gas profits?
Or vice versa, the gas against the oil.
I'm sure that they do exist, and specific examples of, you know, where you have the two different types of production and credits can cross the fence, as we say. I mean, many countries apply and allow either credits or the cousin to credits that we call uplifts, investment allowances, and things like that. But when governments have different terms for gas, as they often do, and quite often they do, the statistics that I showed, and I know there were a lot of those, the world average government take, even right now, is probably 67 or 70, depending on how you calculate it. Wood Mackenzie aggregates those statistics a little bit differently, too, and they'll probably come out. But if the Wood Mackenzie world average government take statistic from their study, I think, was 71%, the world average statistic for gas take is maybe 61. When you have a different tax system for one versus the other. Then you've got problems.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Cook Inlet is keeping me awake at night. What do we do if the companies are working both in Cook Inlet and up on the slope? How do we address it?
Well, through the chair, Representative Olson, things aren't rosy right now at $60 a barrel, but I'm like a lot of those guys. In fact, I think I'm like all of them. I remember the 1980s and what happened. And very few companies, it seems, are investing on the basis of an oil price assumption consistent with $60 a barrel and anything higher. I don't think they would mind giving up something on the upside, which would be at $60 a barrel. But if oil prices drop below 40, people start to feel the pain right away. And below 30, it's going to be very painful, especially if you have a tax that takes too much. Am I standing too close to this? Well, that does help. I don't think at $40 a barrel, people in the Cook Inlet deserve any more pain than they already would be experiencing. And even more analysis is required to ensure that you don't do something that hurts them. You want to, and as far as exploration is concerned, you want to put a smile on their face. If you want the kind of robust exploration that some people appear to want, people are excited and interested in that. If that's what you want, then you've got to put a smile on their face. As far as others on the North Slope, the producers, boy, right now they have a smile on their face. There's no doubt about that, and good for them. Oil companies have worked through the 80s and 90s. Exploration was very discouraging and very unproductive. The only people that aren't smiling right now, mostly the Alaskans, knowing that with these high oil prices, they'd like to get more than they're getting. I hope that answers your question. I have some doubts.
I don't think there is an answer, but thanks.
Representative Berkowitz. Thanks very much. Next time you ought to bring your kids up here to help the tourism industry, too. All six of them. You talked early on about the elasticity of production, particularly for legacy fields. And I was wondering if you had an ability to quantify the increase in tax rates for legacy fields as opposed to how that would affect production decisions. And if you would have a strategy for treating legacy leases differently from new fields or new and unexplored fields.
And through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, we actually are speaking the same language. I was talking about the elasticity of investment relative to fluctuations in taxes, and there's a lot of literature on the subject. My research and my experience has been that it's not extremely elastic. It's in fact mostly inelastic, but of course that's a function of just how high you raise the tax. I think there's no more drama than what we saw in the UK when they dropped the tax from 85 to 30. Thank you. I hope that works.
You're doing well,
too
Daniel.
Well. When they dropped that tax from 85 to 30, that is a huge amount. And investment activity in dollars really slowed down. And the greatest drama was the exploration activity. But it wouldn't be fair to use just what information I have so far. It could be that just the prospects would have nearly run out. I doubt that that's entirely the case. There are a lot of factors involved, but investment activity went down in terms of dollars. In terms of the number of exploratory wells, yes. But if you look at the 3 years before 1993, when they dropped that tax so dramatically, and the 3 years after, there were a few more wells drilled. But the change was only 3%. I think it was like 320 wells per year the 3 years before 1993. And the 3 years after, it was 3% higher, whatever that comes to, maybe 340 or something like that. It just, to me, that's some powerful information, and it flies in the face of what was said. So the issue is this. If you raise taxes, will it have an influence on the production in the North Slope? And the answer is absolutely. If you raise taxes, there will be a response. But it depends on how much you raise the taxes. The thing is, though, and what we have to try and measure and come to terms with is, you don't want to, you know, create more pain than gain. And my personal feeling is, you could raise the taxes and, you know, X percent and get a certain amount of gain. And the production might not be able to maintain production under those circumstances, and you might not get as much oil out in the next few years. But the pain might not be so great. You might, you know, make $1 billion a year more, but you'll have $300 million a year less on average through a certain period because they didn't produce as aggressively and they didn't redevelop and do things like that. It's a trade-off. And the natural question is to find out just what would be reasonable and appropriate. But increasing taxes, I think, would probably have more beneficial effect than the adverse effect of a reduction in production, unless you just do something crazy up there.
Representative Rutherford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, there's been a number of the committee members have asked me today about the issue and the variability of different provinces and one of the problems that we have legally that's been referred to and the boundaries that Dr. Van Meers had when he was designing the PPT. Many of us, I believe, wish to make some major distinctions between, for example, the Cook Inlet area, frontier exploration, the heavy oil assets we have in the state. But I think we are feel restricted by the legal constraints, not only the Kuno case, but there's another apportionment fairness issue that speaks to the Commerce Clause. But I would ask that you look at this from your perspective and not a legal perspective, because let's just assume that there's an act of Congress that takes care of these legal issues and that you have the ability to make recommendations to the committees and to the legislature that allows us a little greater freedom to make the carve these things out. In other words, what you think would be the ideal type of structure if we were without those legal constraints? And that might be helpful to you, at least to help generate some discussion and thinking about what we can do. And I'd like you, if you could comment on that and then on the on heavy oil specifically in other jurisdictions, about additional tax credits there and how that would maybe more helpful to those specific types of product we want to live.
Sure. Representative Roper? To a certain extent, we see a little bit of that flexibility. It might sound strange. You haven't seen heavy oil addressed directly in this bill. But there is some flexibility, because if somebody has a heavy oil field that they would like to develop, that they feel that there's not sufficient justification from a financial point of view, then there are means by which I believe you can reduce the royalty, and there are other mechanisms, and even if there weren't, I believe that would be extremely appropriate because if you want heavy oil production and you want to, you know, because if it's sitting there, it's not doing anybody any good. I think it's a wonderful thing to provide whoever the regulatory agency or some, you know, government official, the means by which they could provide some fiscal relief of some sort, in which case all of a sudden you absolutely do have a different class of investor. And so that's just one variation on the overall thing. I would like to see the state of Alaska have that kind of flexibility on an area-wide basis. Cook Inlet, North Slope, Exploration, some of the other basins, and the producing assets up in the North Slope that would enable you guys to tailor each one. So we actually do see a little bit of that. And if legal issues aside, I personally think it could work. It's going to have its problems. There's no doubt about that. But I think I'd be more comfortable going that direction personally.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I actually have two questions. The first one is hopefully easy. When the oil companies presented to us early last week, they used this term, predictability and durability. And each one that came used the same term. I almost thought maybe they had talked about it prior. Doesn't the PPT offer at least as much, if not greater, predictability and durability than the ELP?
Through the chair, Senator Gatto.
Representative
Gatto. I don't blame them for wanting predictability and durability, no doubt. That they get enough grief as it is, and around this world, governments are changing their terms just like you are, or they're getting ready to, and fortunately for the producers in Alaska, this will probably feel a lot less painful than what they're going to feel in other parts of the world. But when they talk about predictability and durability, I think they're going beyond just the contract terms and contract design that would make more durable and predictable. I think they're wanting, quote, fiscal certainty, unquote, in the stability term context. Some contracts have stability terms. They're wanting a stability term, a stability provision that will push back the frontiers, very likely push back the frontiers of stability provisions, in which case things can be very predictable and very durable, but the risk is great for the state of Alaska.
Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Daniel, what about progressivity? You know, there are those of us that like to see 25 or 30 or 35%, but not until the price of oil warrants it so that there's plenty on the table for everybody. What kind of a formula would you recommend for progressivity if we land somewhere near the 2020 place that we're at now? When should we see 25? When should we see 30? I know that the way it was explained to us, the line kind of goes like this as the price of oil escalates due to some, you know, hurricane, a war, a oil line being blown up, some, you know, China growing 11%.
Through the chair, Representative Ramos. As a matter of fact, some of what you mentioned is consistent with the issue of predictability. The type of sliding scale I would recommend, and in some ways I almost, it's a kind of simplistic type of sliding scale, but I think for your situation it might be the best, and frankly, the simpler the better, would be a situation where you had a sliding scale based on prices, and it could be a step scale. I'm being non-specific about just how it would change with respect to prices, but it would influence a production-based tax. If you try to influence the PPT itself, then you have a PPT and associated credits and things that could potentially change from year to year. That's very unpredictable and very problematic. So what would be a lot less problematic and more predictable would be to have the sliding scale that would allow the government to get a greater share, but you have to go back to the production-based mechanism. That way, the credits remain stable. What does vary is the company's profits and the government's profits, but they would vary theoretically in the appropriate way. So you'd be right back to that tax base that we had before, which was net production after royalty.
Thank you. Okay, on cost recovery, both the industry and the administration both testified that the concern is, can you possibly ever audit these global entities where the cost recovery is actually what their costs are? And the examples that they gave was that Prudhoe and Kuparuk in particular, where the big amounts of oil are, that they audit each other. So you're kind of looking over the shoulder, and they don't trust each other any more than we trust them or they trust us, and you have a good dynamic there. And on other fields, and the only points in these other fields that are standalone for one company, that there are, and the term wasn't off-the-shelf, but the concept was basically you had an off-the-shelf product you can buy for the audits, and it is done around the world for the cost recovery to make sure you don't get gamed. So are you comfortable with, I guess, even the concept or the language in the bill on cost recovery so that Alaska doesn't constantly worry that the big guys around the globe are playing us?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels. Chairman Samuels.
Ralph, whatever.
This is a huge issue that concerns so many people, and it's something with which I'm fairly comfortable, actually, and have less concern than many government officials do. And there's a number of reasons for that, some of which you mentioned. One is, oil companies have a real strong incentive here in particular to keep their costs down. And there's a metric that I developed a few years ago to help quantify that. And it works like this, because so often this question comes up. Every single government asks the same question. You know, how do we make sure they keep costs down? And the answer to that question is, well, first of all, let's see if they have an incentive to keep costs down. You know, and so the question is, under the current system now, if they keep costs down, how much do they get to keep? Because the effective tax rate of the profits-based tax mechanisms is, let's use 41%, that's the number I've been using, that is the combined tax rate between the Fed and the state of Alaska. So if they spend a dollar, they get the tax deduct and all those expenditures. So at the end of the day, they really only spent 59 cents on the dollar. And which, by the way, by world standards is pretty high. So they want to keep their costs down even more than usual. In Indonesia, I talked about the contract there. There, when they spend a dollar, they only get to keep 15 cents on the dollar because the profits-based mechanisms in the system take 85% of the profits. And so some people feel that the incentive to keep costs down is quite low there. Companies still stay awake at night trying to figure out how to keep costs down, even in places like Indonesia, because my metric, and I call it the savings index, basically is an undiscounted number. So one, just from the beginning, the very beginning, companies have an incentive to keep costs down. And another thing, too, in order to keep costs down, one of the practices that's so common throughout the industry is they procure and tender for goods and services and through the bidding process, and sometimes it's required, it's a regulation. Wouldn't be surprised if you require that they tender for goods and services at various levels of expenditure here, too. And that's easy to audit, and you can see, okay, they took three bids and they got the best bid. And so that's powerful. That's a very important thing for oil companies. In order for them to keep costs down, and they have an incentive to do that. As far as cheating, and I know a lot of people worry about that, yes, from a financial point of view, a company has an incentive to cheat, and you can measure that, because in some countries, from a financial point of view, they have a greater incentive than others. And you can ask, well, if they pretend that they spent a dollar that they didn't really pretend, because it's tax deductible and stuff, how much do they get to keep? Well, it amounts to about 49 cents on the dollar. Jeez, I'm not 59 cents on the dollar plus 41 should be a dollar. The penalties are pretty severe, and it's pretty difficult to do, and especially, as you mentioned, with partners. And I often refer to partners as the watchdogs of the industry, and then they can be vicious. They're even worse than auditors sometimes, the government auditors. So you've got, and then there's AFE in the budget process that helps provide some transparency at times. The procurement requirements, if there are requirements, that usually can be audited. So you've got the auditors, you've got the working interest partners, you've got the normal inclination to keep costs down. And that can often be quite healthy. The one thing that's difficult for governments is administration and overhead charges. And that's kind of a tough one because, like me, many government officials agree that administrative and overhead charges are a legitimate cost, full stop. It's an important part of getting oil out of the ground that will benefit Alaska citizens. The question is, though, that's one that's a little more difficult to measure. So some countries use artificial formulas to try to emulate what might be a reasonable general and administrative cost or an overhead cost. It'll be a function of level of expenditures, level of capital expenditures, and sometimes the level of operating expenditures.
Thank you. I've got Representative Seaton, Aguirre, and then Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. Daniel, first of all, you expressed some real concern about the $73 million allowance. And I'm curious about whether that's based on the way it was constructed, 5,000 barrels a day times $53 a barrel, West Coast, and whether you'd be more comfortable if that was 5,000 barrels based on the more historic or estimated, say, $30 a barrel. Is that the kind of, does that give you more comfort, or is there a different formulation that you're looking for the allowance?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. I think to a certain extent, there was a bit of art involved. And thank goodness Dr. Pedro Van Mieris is working on that because he's got good instinct and good experience. And because a lot of this is science and some of it is art. And so he's experienced in that way. And he acknowledges that, hey, this wasn't just all science. It's some of his gut feel. Okay? And it just turns out that at $40 a barrel times 5,000 barrels a day gives you $73 million a year. But that allowance is applied against cash flow, not gross revenues. And so it could be a 10,000 barrel a day field, or it could be a little bit more depending upon costs and prices. And so I don't want people to get too comfortable with the magic number of 5,000 barrels a day, because you can see, let's imagine you had one company that was operating one field and they had 20,000 barrels a day of production, and everybody in Alaska is saying, but they're not paying any taxes. How can they be able, they're producing more than 5,000 barrels a day? Well, it could be that at 20,000 barrels a day, their net cash flow is less than the magical $73 million a year mark. I think to a certain extent, 5,000 barrels a day was a reality check, perhaps, and I don't think it's entirely appropriate to speak for Pedro, but I don't have anything disparaging to say in this respect. I'm not comfortable with 73, and I don't think he's terribly comfortable with it, but you've got to try and come up with something that's going to work. And so he modeled it and tested it under a variety of circumstances and scenarios to see, okay, what category of companies does this provide enough protection to, particularly the Cook Inlet companies, because they didn't need increased taxes. Unless oil prices get even higher, then all of a sudden, maybe they could handle that. So I hope that answers your question. Yeah, that's about all I can do on that.
And then additionally, I didn't quite understand your response to, I think it was Representative Ramos, about progressivity, and you said for some reason that needed to be based on a production model instead of a profits model. I mean, I think we've been talking about a percent of profits, and then when barrel prices went above $80 a barrel, it would increase by a certain percentage of that profit margin. Does that not work? Or?
Correct, it does not. Okay. Through the chair, Representative Seaton. I might, strangely as it may seem, I much prefer that levies and the means by which governments get a piece of the pie, to a large extent, are profits-based, no doubt about that. But if we propose a sliding scale with the type of system that's proposed now, and the tax rate changed, could change every day, no doubt about that, but then so would the credit rate. And so you have tax rates and credit rates changing, and the company could make a bunch of investments and then later on find that they're not able to credit. It would create much more uncertainty and less predictability. And so I think be just a lot simpler with a sliding scale, which you have to have of some sort, in my opinion, to have it based on net production. By the way, a little bit of irony there, because that's going to be regressive. So you know, hopefully you structure it so that the progressive effect of the steps or the sliding scale relative to price offset the regressive nature of the levy based on something other than profits.
Well, and just follow up on that, Mr. Chairman, is it necessary that if we say above $80 a barrel, it went an additional 2.5% on the profits as far as the tax went? Why is it necessary to have that change to credit amount?
Oh, through the chair, Representative Seaton. As a matter of fact, you could have that, but you could have it changed. You'd have to have another formula to accommodate that. Because, right, and because remember, sometimes people refer to two credits. And the reason for that is just ordinary tax deductions can be sold if you don't have enough coverage somewhere else. Sometimes we refer to those as credits. I think it causes more problems, and I'd have to think it through a lot more, but in my instinct and various ways I've looked at it, I think it just keeps it so much simpler. What's the credit rate? Well, it changes from year to year. Both dimensions of that.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I certainly want to hear everything over the long term you have to recommend to us, and I certainly look forward to that. It might be that before we get your next round of recommendations, these bills start moving through the legislature, and so I just want to get as much as I can from you now while we still have you. Is it possible, if we were just going to ask you for maybe a range of fair tax rates just on legacy fields, not on new production, but just on legacy fields on the North Slope, would you be able to give us what, and assuming that some form of this PPT goes forward instead of a production tax, if that's the constraint, some form of this PPT goes forward, and we were just asking you for your input on what kind of sliding scale tax on just legacy fields might be appropriate, could you give us any guidance on a range of numbers that might apply for a fair tax for those fields?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. Well, I'm uncomfortable to do that now, and it's a bit premature. I'm agonizing over some of the other things. But I can say that at $20 a barrel, they start to feel pain, even the producers up there. And $20 a barrel West Texas price. But at 60, it's not nearly so painful. So for one thing, I would say the sliding scale has to accommodate the downside, but also the upside, and I think which we are experiencing in time, bearing which there's some real upside being experienced. And I think it would be fair for the state of Alaska to be getting more rather than less. And an evaluation of what the take is now relative to what perhaps it should be at 60%, in my opinion, should be a function of, in part, where you should be, but also a sliding scale that has enough flexibility to make it look like a true sliding scale. And then also the modeling that's required to test the pain threshold and what the responses might be to an increase in the taxes to the production profile and the future decline rates and stuff like that. So it's going to require some modeling, no doubt. But I think that would be a much more comfortable area for me to go. I think that if the boundary condition that we have one system is replaced with a more flexible system, an arrangement that allows us to segregate areas or fields.
Okay. Last question, and then we'll let Mr. Johnson go down the hall and visit our friends in the other body. For people that want to hear the presentation, you start at 3:30, I believe, in the Senate. At 3:30, he'll be giving the presentation to their joint finance resources. So if you want to hear the presentation again, he'll be right down the hall. We'll give you a couple minute breather. The last question belongs to Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, referring back to your earlier comment on what you were just talking to Representative Gore about and others, you said that you either made a suggestion or you raised the possibility, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that when we're talking about a progressive system, that we could make a reversion to the old L for the drop below a certain price. So I'm very concerned about that. I'd like you to clarify that. Number one, is that in fact what you advocated? Number two, you're talking about and have been advocating for a progressive system with maximum flexibility. But it seems to me as if we revert to the old elf, that's we're going back to something that's allegedly broken, and that seems to be no sense. And then additionally, are there other Western European, or yet Western civilization or capitalist countries that even adopt anything like that? You gave a couple of examples. I'm not sure they would be in the Western capitalist traditions in terms of fairness and so forth when we do something like that. And also, in the last part of that is, you've even described this as a two knives situation, I think, is what you used. But I'm not sure where you went to the jugular and what other part of the body you went to. So, could you explain that to the committee, please?
Through the chair, Representative Brookford. In some contracts, they have sliding scales, and once you step up to a certain point, they have what we call no going back language. So that if the sliding scale would otherwise have gone back down, then they don't want the tax rate to go back down, tax rates can only go up. And I don't like that, but this thing is slightly similar to that.
They have curved swords there?
Well, okay, that terminology came from Kazakhstan.
Okay.
In Kazakhstan, the famous old contract for the big discovery there is called Kashagan. And the Kashagan contract has more scales than a fish. It's got three sliding scales for what they call a crocodile split, which is a tax. And the Cossacks are real proud of that. You calculate the tax three different ways, and whichever yields the highest rate, that's what the government takes. And I mentioned New Zealand has a similar thing in Newfoundland, as I recall. And those are the only ones that come to mind right now. Now, you hit on the same thing the oil industry hits on in Kazakhstan. They refer to the three knives as the three daddies. And I don't blame them. Kazakhstan is on par with Bolivia these days, and it's just a rough, rough situation. You talk about political instability and a lack of understanding and appreciation for the industry. There's so much mistrust and so much bitterness. It's just a poisonous atmosphere. It's really tough there. Basically, what I was talking about is your two knives was, I wouldn't want you to see create a system that has, as you say, maximum flexibility, because if you want to go the full distance with a truly progressive system and have maximum flexibility, the ultimate in flexibility, that would mean as oil prices go way down or as profitability goes way down, then the government take gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, so that you could end up really in tough shape. And even the progressive systems of this world have a limit beyond which they will not go. And that's basically the way I was looking at it. I didn't want to see Alaska, under just about any circumstances, end up worse off than you already are. And that's why I said, with some of these formulas, the uncertainty, there's so many factors, it's hard to know what could happen under a variety of circumstances, or if, you know, somebody figures out a way to play with the system. It's hard to know in advance just what the possible outcomes might be. And so my attitude is, well, the very worst, make sure that you don't do any worse than what you've got. So with a sliding scale, due to perhaps some unforeseen circumstances, and with so many variations and so many new things, the likelihood for unforeseen circumstances is great. So I felt that somebody suggested that well, maybe you can just say if the sliding scale formula, or the PPT, drops down below what we would have gotten without, we'll just revert to elf. And I thought, there you go, better than none.
Getting hit with a dagger.
Well, there's always one dagger, you just get hit with another dagger.
Okay, thank you very, very much, and I'm sure that we will all be in touch with you. As House Resources tomorrow, we'll meet at 12:30. We'll be working with the Department of Revenue. If they have the questions back for them, we'll have a meeting. If not, I will send another set to all the members and probably cancel and go on Wednesday instead. But 12:30 for House Resources tomorrow, and for Finance...
Actually, 9 o'clock tomorrow.
9 o'clock tomorrow morning for Finance. We're adjourned.
Great job. Yeah, we're doing
you're welcome.
Get that mic up. That will do.